on WRIF in WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Jalene Jordan, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Peter.
This is WRIF's phone-in talk show. You can reach us at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And here's the way it goes. When you call, you reach our phone screener, Roger, and then we have this program that links his...
His computer to our computer.
Yeah, he's in a different room.
His studio to our studio.
And right now... Whoop. We're having long... There it is.
We're back on.
Mark, you rock. Well, what we're talking about was this was not working.
We had kind of a similar issue last week.
Yeah.
And let's not bore everyone with this like technical talk, but what's the cool thing about it is our engineers can fix this stuff from home.
From home. That's
amazing.
Nice.
Amazing.
That's nice. Well, the poop's coming down in Iran, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes,
yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. I heard something today that kind of threw me for a loop, and that was someone who had no sympathy whatsoever for the ruling clique, as
mm-hmm.
they call it, in Iran. And he says it's very, very possible that the election results showing two-thirds of the voters going for Ahmadinejad, the current president,
yep.
was not rigged, but in fact was accurate. That mm-hmm. what you're seeing, particularly in Tehran, the capital, is the more educated, the intellectual strata, the people, the essentially the modernists, the people that want to leave this one nation under God situation that has been forced on them for the last 20 years. So that's interesting. I mean, really, that so we were taking it for granted that that the reformer had won and he had had the election stolen from him.
Mm-hmm.
But it could be the other way around. But it actually gives you an idea how the minorities can work in history. Because usually, it's not like 80% of the people are doing things. There's, if you think about who took part in the American Revolution or any of the big events of history, usually it's a pretty small strata of the population. So,
right, it absolutely is.
And I guess here, maybe they're trying to really make sure that it's a small strata. Because last week, someone said, remember the email, Jalene? Someone said to me, you read it. It was an email. And they said, why are you talking about Rush Limbaugh when Iran is exploding? Talk
right.
about Rush Limbaugh next week. Let's talk about Iran. So that led me into a discussion of what was planned between Sunday and Wednesday in downtown Detroit. And what it was a People's Summit in Tent City. And this was 4 days of demonstrations, of meetings, of strategizing sessions. How can we bring the focus of the economy away from the elites, away from the huge financial concerns, and back to the people?
Yeah, it was bail out the people, not the banks, what they were chanting.
Yeah, exactly. And I said, I knew, though, that probably it was going to be, quote, the activists who are going to show up. That is opposed, and the activists, and Gaia bless them and us and what have mm-hmm. you, is that these are the people that that move outside of the quotidian, the daily life of that we all need to take care of, right? Our jobs, our family, our neighborhood, our lawns, our cars, you know, all of this stuff, and start looking at the political and social and economic questions that confront every nation. Now we're in a big crisis. So the, quote, activists, and the reason I'm putting quotes around that is it's beyond me why, just like in Tehran, why we're not all activists.
Absolutely.
And so they, as I gave all the specifics for this bail out the people, not the banks,
mm-hmm.
this national People's Summit in Tent City. And what was going on, business leaders from the CEOs from these major companies met at the Renaissance Center to discuss America's future in the global economy, and you know it was only on their terms. They always think of trickle down. In other words, the old what's good for General Motors is good for the U.S. They said that 50 years ago. I don't know if anybody would dare to say it now. But, you know, they're still possessed of essentially that same mindset. If they can make the economy hum in terms of this enormous profit structure for the elite, for the wealthy elite, then, you know, there'll be some crumbs, maybe even some fat crumbs left for people down the line. And usually there'd be a strata of the middle class that did well. I mean, think about the 90s and the 80s and what have you. The people that are really doing the hard work in this society, people that are, you know, doing the jobs that most of us wouldn't want to do, and the people that are doing them aren't real happy doing it, they get screwed no matter what, and they get screwed worse in times like this. So the idea was, and the people that put together the People's Summit in Tent City, is let's restructure the priorities for this country, and instead of, pardon me, thinking about it solely in terms of what's good for the elite will be good for the rest of us. Let's talk about what's good for the rest of us. And then if the elite are able to get a bit of a profit, and you know they always
will. Which they will, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, but we're starting off on the wrong foot. And a number of people are beginning to have doubts about Barack Obama. Well, I don't know why you would have doubts about Barack Obama. He never said he was a revolutionary. He never said he was going to find a cure for cancer or something like that. So he was handed a situation.
A really, really bad one.
Yeah. He was dealt some bad cards brought on by almost 30 years of Reaganomics and came to their disastrous conclusion. You come to a disastrous apex or whatever height under Bush, and Barack Obama is solving these problems with some of the same people that have been along for the ride the whole time, the Larry Summers, the Wall Street people, and what have you. And there's why should he do anything any different? It's not like did I say how many people came out to these rallies and demonstrations? I didn't hear in Detroit. 150.
And
not 150,000.
Not enough.
Yeah, not 150,000.
By any means.
Not 15,000. Not 1,500. 150 activists, if you will. And there are some stalwarts there, and I'm not critical of them. And I talked to some people, and they said, you know, I never heard a thing about it. Well, I mean, these folks did try their hardest to get the word out. I don't know.
Yeah.
And we did. But I suspect the fact that there were, I mean, there should have been enough of you. You know, this sounds like I'm being a scolding teacher or a scold, you know, as a noun. I'm being a scold. And to some, you know, I have to say, neither Jalene nor I were there.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I work all weekend.
Yeah. And during the week, we had meetings during right at the time. Yeah.
And I work all week. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. I understand there are things that.
But I'm not making excuses or anything.
I am. I am.
Okay, I am.
Yeah. But it shouldn't be, well, maybe this is it. I was going to say it shouldn't depend on two of us, but maybe it didn't depend on you. It didn't depend on the next person. It didn't depend on the next person. So it wound up there was a handful, a paltry handful of people that represented the interests of the people. So most of the media, the exceptions were there was an article in the Detroit Free Press, Activist Protest National Summit, and there was a long piece on WDET. You know, the public radio station. So there was some, but mostly, and I mean, people begin to expect that. Whenever people in power show up, there's always like a handful of people that go, you know, na 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 na.
Right.
And we love them. Sometimes we're the people going na 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 out in the streets. But we should be talking about substantial change. And what's going on now is fix it up. And it might. I mean, there are these new regulations that Obama has suggested. And I know that's going to send some of you off the deep end, the fact that it's actually going to give more power to the Federal Reserve. And yet that's his solution. So this might actually cure things. The stock market is turning around some. Real estate is starting to pick up again. So the upper echelons, and that's how everything's measured, you know, of the fact that there's people, you know, 100 millions of people unemployed, people underemployed, wages are being cut, benefits are being cut. That doesn't usually follow in that occasion. I'm sorry, equation. What am I thinking? I'm thinking of too many things.
Well, that's okay. There's a lot to be.
Yeah, there is.
Gone over tonight.
The The Saturday Free Press still comes out, doesn't it?
It does.
No cash for some jobless. 34% of out-of-work Michiganders can't collect assistance was the headline. Despite billions of federal dollars being poured into Michigan's unemployment benefits program, the safety net for jobless workers doesn't stretch far or wide enough for a growing number of residents. As the state's jobless rate hits its high mark, the highest mark in quarter century, more than 232,000 jobless Michiganders, 34% of the unemployed, were not eligible for benefits due to the program rules. Another major problem, a growing number of unemployed residents are running out of benefits, even though payments have been extended several times. What are these people going to do? And if you're one of them, give us a call. What do you do? I mean, how badly can the rug be pulled out from under you? And what obligation does the society have? Remember, there was this old mean-spirited, probably thought up by some conservative, the world doesn't owe you a living. In other words, if you suffer bad times, hey, it's too bad.
Yeah.
You know, screw
Suck
you.
Suck it up.
Well, the people that are suffering the bad times, they didn't create this. You know, they didn't put it together. It wasn't working class people, wasn't middle class people, certainly wasn't the poor. It was the wealthy elite that made egregious mistakes based on short-term greed and the idea that they could do whatever they wanted. The nickname for these guys on Wall Street is Masters of the Universe.
Oh, yeah.
They were so just filled with themselves, with arrogance and a sense of power and
Did
privilege.
You say were?
Yeah, now that you're right. Now they're all back into it. The Wall Street Journal says shopping becomes a challenge as auto industry collapse adds to Detroit's woes. They call this the Motor City, but you have to leave town to buy a Chrysler or a Jeep.
Boy.
The last Lockmore Chrysler Jeep closed down. Borders was founded in Ann Arbor, but the only one of the chain's bookstores has closed this month, which must have been the one in Campus Martius. CompuWare building.
Mm-hmm.
I understood, anyways. They and Rock, what's that rock place? You know, they got them, people get the
Hard Rock?
Hard Rock Cafe, yeah. That they were getting free rent there. I mean, just so that they wouldn't look like it was empty storefront.
Oh, wow.
I have that on good...
faith?
Yeah, no. Yeah. Starbucks has only 4 places left. But here, this is a lack of outlets that sell fresh produce and meat has led the United Food and Commercial Workers Union and a community group to think about building a grocery store of its own.
Really?
So we've been depending on the elites. Yeah, yeah. I mean, if we can do that. The city's 22.8% unemployment rate is the highest in the U.S.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's depression. We're not talking recession here in Detroit, folks. We're talking depression. And believe me, if it's 23% officially, you can only imagine what it is really.
Right.
Yeah. 30% of the residents are on food stamps.
I think as much as you can get down to those farmers markets, the better. And, you know, keep in mind to shop locally as much as you can, please. And I found out, you know, and I'll give it a little bit of a plug. On Wednesdays, there is a farmers market down at Wayne State.
There is.
Yes, I just found out about this. So it's not just the Eastern Market or the Royal Oak Market. There's yeah. during the week where you can shop as well, and you can support people right here in this own state and probably eat a lot more healthy.
Sure, if you're buying processed foods, you're paying top dollar and probably getting the least healthy food you can get.
Right, so you can spend the same amount and get something that's better for you.
Somewhere I just read it said if you're eating food in a package that has a list of ingredients
yeah.
on it,
Don't do it.
You're paying a lot, and you're not getting the healthiest food.
Have you seen the sodium levels on some of these prepackaged frozen foods?
Oh, it's amazing.
I mean, Peter, we're talking like 1,900 milligrams.
For one dish.
Yeah,
yeah. That's why it tastes so good.
Yeah, that's true.
Your calls to me, Peter Werby, and Jalene Jordan here at WRIF, 313-298-WRIF for the bashful. And when the lines are filled, then there's a couple open right now. Call talkyes@yahoo.com. And one of the difficulties in discussing this all is, what do we do? This was the importance of this People's Summit and Tent City. And I don't know what came out of it. If any of you were there, it's not a lot of folks, let us know. Because what they were trying to do was to develop strategies for something that we could do. We're not sitting around having hope. Hope is not very audacious. I don't know why Barack Obama came up with that title. I mean, hope. I mean, I hope they bail us out. I hope everything doesn't go to hell. I hope, you know, I get a job. I hope. Well, that's, you know, what is that? I mean, that's pretty passive.
Well, it's kind of like religion and praying for something.
Yeah, right. Well, you might as well pray. Pray for a job. Pray for a turnaround in the economy. Pray that we don't get screwed too badly anymore.
Yeah.
Wide support for government health plan, according to a poll. I mean, Barack Obama, again, operating within the political space that he has inherited. In other words, he's got to deal with all these senators and representatives that get millions of dollars of campaign contributions from these big health corporations that want everything just as it is because they're making billions and billions off of our illnesses. I mean, it's a racket, essentially. All the major institutions of this society have developed into rackets. Rackets that fleece someone. Do I have to really go through the list of who's getting fleeced? And benefits of the fleecers. We're the fleecees, I guess. Let me see.
We certainly are.
State Wayne Theater is where the market is not. What?
Wait, Wayne State Theater? Would that
no, it
be
says
it?
State Wayne Theater is where the market is not Wayne State, a caller called in.
Oh, I thought it was down in the Wayne State area.
What's the State Wayne Theater?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
But let's figure it out.
Call
so we're not
back.
Sending people to the wrong
yeah,
place.
Yeah, I wonder where that is. 72% of us questioned said they backed a government-administered insurance plan similar to Medicare for those under 65 that would compete for customers within the private sector. 20% said they were opposed only. So the idea of a government-sponsored health plan has overwhelming, even among Republicans, overwhelming support. And one of the things in this bill that's getting watered down more and more and more is how's it going to be paid for? I mean, we're spending $1 trillion a year on war. There's no money here. All right, here, apparently the farmer's market, it's in Wayne, Michigan, off of Michigan Avenue.
What? No, that okay, that's a different one. There is one down at Wayne State as well.
Someone just wrote that?
No, I heard an entire report on it the other day on an NPR station.
Okay. All right. Let's see. President Barack Obama is scheduled to speak at the American Medical Association. He did on Monday. Dr. Carol Aaron, pardon me, lead author of a study published in the Annals of Internal Medicine on doctors' views on a national health program, he said, we conducted what is by far the largest poll done of doctors and found that 59% of U.S. physicians favor government legislation to establish national health insurance, an increase of 10 percentage points from 5 years ago. Much of the general public and Congress seem to think that the AMA represents doctors, but that is far from the case. Most doctors are not members of the organization, and the group has ties to financial interests opposed to reforms, he says. So not only are most doctors likely for a so-called public option that Obama is proposing, but they are for a much more fundamental reform of establishing national health insurance. So we shouldn't just be talking about what Barack Obama is talking about. We should be talking about what all the other industrialized countries have. A single-payer, government-funded health program that provides health care to everyone. If you don't want to be in it, you want to go to your private doctor still, and you can, you know, there's all sorts of private health plans that you or your physician, you or your employer could have.
Affording them.
Well, no. You mean if you're out by yourself.
Oh, man.
Yeah. All right. But, hey, if you have Medicare, you can still go to a doctor of your choice, right?
I really don't know about that.
Yeah, sure. So that's not a problem. Okay, 313-298-WRIF. Let me see. Oh, yeah, anybody, I don't know, I was going to read this, but is there anybody that still thinks that Canadian health care sucks or something like that? Taxes in, I'll go through a few of them. Taxes in Canada are extremely high, mostly because of national health care. Pardon me, in actuality, taxes are nearly equal on both sides of the border. Canada's taxes are slightly higher than those in the U.S. However, Canadians are afforded many benefits for their tax dollars, even beyond health care. Tax credits, family allowance, cheaper higher education, so at the end, it's about the same. At the end of the day, the average after-tax income of Canadian workers is equal to about 82% of their gross pay. In the U.S., it's 81.9%. Canada's health care is a cumbersome bureaucracy. The U.S. has the most bureaucratic health care system in the world. Yeah, I don't know how they can. More than 31% of every dollar spent on health care in the U.S. goes to paperwork, overhead, CEO salaries, profits, etc. The provincial, this is Canada, single-payer system in Canada operates with just 1% overhead. And the author, Rhonda Hackett, says, think about it. It's not necessary to spend a huge amount of money to decide who gets care and who doesn't when everyone is covered. There's a bunch more. Canada's government decides who gets health care and when they get it. And they debunked that. Well, and if anybody's got a comment on that, well, I'll go through more. Maybe you agree that it's not so bad. In the meantime, another $200 billion supplemental for the Afghanistan war. And this, yeah, you know, more deaths, more civilian deaths, more U.S. deaths. You know that there's tens of thousands of wounded U.S. servicemen from the Iraq and Afghanistan war?
Yeah.
We know that, boy, I have to look at my own website.
Do you still have your sign in your yard, Peter?
Yeah.
I haven't noticed lately. I drive by and it's
like... What does it say? Troops home now. Troops home
same
now.
One.
Yeah,
you know what?
A lot of my neighbors do.
Here's something really cool. Is my next door neighbor, we decided that she's with me on the whole thing, so we put it in between the two houses.
Oh, that's cool.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
And not to get totally off track, but to go back to this farmer's market thing, because I think it's important. It's the Wayne State Farmer's Market on Cass Avenue, just north of Warren, in front of Prentice Hall, every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Yeah, good place. Get fresh vegetables. If it's got a list of ingredients on the side of anything you're buying, you're paying too much, and you're getting food that probably is unhealthy.
Yes.
Or is not as healthy as the fresh stuff.
Yeah.
let's see. American GI toll in Iraq as of today, 4,315. U.S. wounded in Iraq, this is months and months old, 46,132. So we're talking here minimum of 50,000 American casualties in Iraq alone.
And I'd like for someone to remind us why.
Well, What happened? Didn't they have... no, they didn't have any weapons of mass destruction.
OIL.
Yeah. In Afghanistan, 711 Americans have been killed as of today. Again, this is a very old figure. 2,686 have been wounded. And Iraq, it is so elusive how many Iraqis have been killed by in the whole conflict, by U.S. forces, by the internal fighting, but anyway, it goes from a minimum of 100,000 Iraqis have been killed up to as far as a million.
Oh my gosh.
Let's go with the low figure. So we're talking here a couple hundred thousand deaths because of George Bush's lies and Dick Cheney's lies and Colin Powell's lies and all of them. All right. And then, so there's all this money. There's all this money needed, right? Which means, well, we had the war in Iraq, and whereas middle class and working class guys and some women got killed, the companies that supply the weapons of the war,
that paved the roads, that built.
Yeah. All the weapons that have been destroyed, all the ammunition that have been shot off, all the bombs that have been dropped, they are having a field day.
They are profits loaded. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was
yachts, probably.
From the Vietnam War, there was a slogan, war is good business, invest your son, because that's what happens.
Ugh.
The middle class and the working class and few of the poor, they invest their sons and daughters. The profits are reaped by Bush's buddies, by the elite at the top of this society. And it goes on and on. And again, the political space for Barack Obama to do anything different isn't there, so he continues essentially the war policies of George W. Bush. If there was a mass movement that demanded full health care for everybody, if there was a mass movement to demand the end of the war, if there was a mass movement to bail out the people, not the banks, things would change. But as long as we have hope and hope alone, there's not much that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I'll tell you who's on my S list. David Letterman. Can you believe he apologized to Sarah Palin? What a weasel.
Well, I don't think he really apologized.
Yeah,
I watched it. I mean, is this after he did... this is something new?
Well, it says Sarah Palin accepts David Letterman's apology for the joke he made about her daughter.
Yeah, because he was saying... he wasn't talking about the 14-year-old daughter.
He was talking about Bristol.
He was talking about just probably, yeah, for, about Bristol. He was. And I don't know. I didn't look at it as an apology. But apparently she took it as an apology.
A fired David Letterman protest was held Tuesday outside the Ed Sullivan Theater where he tapes the show. About a dozen people showed up.
There, please. I mean, that, those are the only people who still think this woman has one cell in her brain.
Well, and, of course, Todd Palin, he weighed in. Any jokes about raping my 14-year-old daughter are despicable.
I mean, come on.
Will they ever stop using their kids as props? They won't.
No. Even and they'll keep having more so they can continue.
Even when there is a modicum of righteousness on their side and barely. I mean, they set themselves up for this kind of abuse, public abuse and attacks and jokes and what have you. And then they're so indignant when someone makes a joke about them. And then, you know, he pulls this card out.
Yeah.
What a pack of, I don't know what.
Well, and I was telling you earlier, I saw a picture. A friend of mine is in Alaska. And she took a picture of this, I don't know, big construction.
Let's call it a derrick.
A derrick, okay. And on this big sign up on it, it says, "Rape is not a joke, David Letterman."
Oh.
And her caption was, "We're in Palin country. I feel sorry for her."
Right.
Come home.
Well, let's do this. I would take a break about right now, but let's get a couple calls on so people can tell that we are a talk show. 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan. Here is Daryl. Daryl, let me see. This all of a sudden, this screen isn't big enough. This screen isn't big enough for both of us. Let me see. Ah, there we go. Does this do it? No. Does this do it? No. Oh, this is interesting.
Are we having... We're not being...
Oh. See what's happening here?
Yes,
right.
I do.
Okay.
We're going to try it a different way.
I'm going to do it the old-fashioned way. I'm going to lean over here and press a button. I think that'll do it, right? That'll put it
on.
We can say... All right. Yeah, I did. Hey, Daryl. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on WRIF. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
I called in and I talked to you about being going to court about my seatbelt. And you told me to call you back to let you know how I made out.
Oh, yeah. Remind us again of the situation. I remember telling you, but I can't remember exactly. Oh, yeah, yeah. You were handicapped?
I had the ticket, and I gave you the seatbelt law with the 257.710E.
Uh-huh.
I went in and talked to the prosecutor. I pleaded not guilty. And I said exactly what I said. He goes, "You got proof of that?" I go, "Yes." I handed him the thing. I go, "Here's my doctor's note. Here's my note from the cardiologist. Here is my note, my letter from the Department of State." I hand him all of that. He ended up throwing it out.
No, that's good.
Good.
Sent it in up the court. I didn't go in the courtroom. Not only that, but I am starting a petition to get this stuff on people's driver's license or registration.
Well, that would make sense. You know what? You would probably do well, Daryl, to find out, if you don't know, who your state representative is.
I've already called him.
Okay.
I filed a complaint there.
Your Honor.
I also called my state senator.
Yeah.
Of the state and filed a complaint with their office, and they said the same thing, start a petition.
Oh, he actually did say to start a petition. All right, well, good.
You're on it. Way to
all
go.
All right, let's get moving.
Yay!
All right, Daryl fights City Hall and wins. Thanks for the update, Daryl.
Go, Daryl.
Yes, appreciate it. All right, so let's see. Does that take it off? Yep.
We're going to be able to do this.
Yes, we're going to be able to do this. Thank you. That's a good way to put it. Oh, yeah. Here is, boy, I'm getting quite a stretch here. This is James calling from New Hudson. James, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, man. How you doing?
Good.
Good. I just have two quick points. So one of them is, Chrysler and the Big Three bailed us out pretty much back in the day for World War II. And you know what they should do is they should have gave us all the contracts and get them away from these private companies for the war so that, give them the jobs and boost the economy that way. My second point is that when, we can all bash on Fox News pretty easily, but when they showed the Supreme Leader's speech, both the BBC and CNN, broadcast it live, but Fox News just had their regular shows on or whatever. And this is a very important speech. It's translated. Some things might be lost in translation.
Who are we talking about here? The Supreme Leader. So who are we talking about?
Iran.
Iran's the Supreme Leader.
Oh, yeah.
And Fox News, they didn't even show it. Live. You know, and CNN and BBC showed it, but Fox News had their morning shows on, because it was on like 7 in the morning.
Yeah.
But they didn't show it, and if you ask me, that's just like, you're feeding the conservative news, but the reason why they don't want to show it is because, you know, they want to chop it up and, you know, show quotes and context and put their spin on it so they can manipulate, you know, information that's out there.
Every time. With everything.
Well, as I always say, dealing the cruelest blow of all, James, just don't watch them.
Gosh,
all right, thank you.
Don't
thank
do
you for
it
that.
To yourself.
All right, a quick break, and then back to get your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan with you.
This is Night Call.
Whoever controls technology controls the world.
Listening to The Riff has never been easier. On your Apple iPhone 3G, hit the iTunes Store. Download the free WRIF app. Connect with just one touch and listen to 101 WRIF from anywhere in the world. Details at WRIF.com. From 101, good.
Just announced. Now for the month of June, your Metro Detroit Ford dealers and Genuine Ford Parts and Service have great service offers for you. Get the Works Fuel Saver Package for only $29.95 after $10 mail-in rebate. It's a Motorcraft synthetic blend oil change, tire rotation, multi-point inspection, fluid top-off, and more, all for just $29.95. At Ford dealerships, there are Ford-trained technicians using Genuine Ford Parts and guaranteed low prices. So hurry to a participating Metro Detroit Ford dealer today for money-saving rebates on brakes, batteries, tires, and much more. Visit www.thinkfordfirst.com for a dealership near you. Taxes, diesel, and disposal fee extra. See participating dealerships for hours and rebate details through 6:30:09.
Want a chance to win $25,000 towards a new Ford vehicle or a $100 gas card? It's easy, it's fun, and you can play the cash scramble now at winwithford.com. That's winwithford.com from your Metro Detroit Ford dealers.
Do you owe taxes to the IRS that you can't afford to pay? What will you do? Your tax problem will only get worse if you don't do something about it. If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Pick up the phone and call 1-800-493-8157. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debts for less than you owe. Remove penalties and interest, and get the tax collector off your case. As an honest, hard-working American, you do have rights. Don't let your tax problem get worse. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159. Here's more Direct Talk from DirecTV. Today, we're talking stimulus, specifically great TV at a great price kind of stimulus. With DirecTV, enjoy 100% digital picture and sound, including most sports, the greatest movies, and all your local channels. Packages start at just $29.99 a month, and you can lock in your price for a year. With no startup costs and 99.9% digital signal reliability, DirecTV has had higher customer satisfaction rates than cable 8 years in a row. If you're in need of a TV stimulus plan, call 1-888-359-5566. Call right now and ask about free next day installation. Call 1-888-359-5566. That's 1-888-359-5566. Offer ends 7709. New DirecTV customers only, subject to credit approval. Call for details. Among the largest national cable and satellite TV providers, 2008 American Customer Satisfaction Index, University of Michigan Business School.
If you have acne, here's a phone number you need to call. 1-800-335-4191. Right now, we're looking for the biggest skeptics out there to test out a skin-clearing breakthrough risk-free. If that's you, give us a call. We're going to prove you can make your acne disappear and have clear skin by sending you a 60-day trial of Proactive Solution absolutely risk-free with our compliments. And when you call now, we'll also send you our Green Tea Moisturizer, a feather-light serum that absorbs instantly to deliver deep hydration for free. Call 1-800-335-4191. Our combination therapy system uses prescription-grade acne medicine. It's so effective, it transforms blemishes and bumps into clear, smooth skin, and skeptics into believers. You can have beautiful, healthy-looking skin Put Proactiv to the test, and we'll prove it. Get your free Soothing Green Tea Moisturizer with your risk-free 60-day trial by calling now. 1-800-335-4191. 1-800-335-4191.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Jalene Jordan is with me, and we forgot to wish all of you and one another a happy solstice. It is now summer.
It was the longest day.
Yeah, it was.
It was a long day, too.
Last night, there was a wonderful little thing downtown. The Detroit Symphony Orchestra played at Mack and Woodward. Real close to where Orchestra Hall is, and there were 8 performers from the Bandoloop troupe that did aerial ballet. They were being lowered by ropes.
Like on strings and ropes.
From a four-story building, four-story parking structure.
And so I bet there were more people at that than at this, the Tent City.
Oh, there was probably a couple thousand at this. Yeah, it was all free.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I'm trying to remember, I should have brought that because they're having more events. It was called something like Midsummer Midtown or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Is that
what it's called.
Yeah. Midsummer Midtown. And there's stuff going on this coming weekend as well. It's all free. In Stonehenge in England, pagans and partygoers drum, danced, or gyrated in hula hoops to stay awake through the night as more than 35,000 people greeted the summer solstice Sunday at the ancient stone circle of Stonehenge.
Sounds like fun.
I'd like to be there, yeah.
Yeah.
The cops were worried, but it was a record-sized crowd, but it was peaceful. And an antique salesman, Frank Summers, 43, dressed in the robes of his druid faith, said, "It's the most magical place on earth."
Ah.
Yeah. This is
never been there.
Well, me neither. A prehistoric monument in southern England is the site of an annual night-long party or religious ceremony, depending on perspective, marking the longest day of the year in the northern hemisphere. And now the days are starting to get short again.
I know. Well.
Oh, man.
I know. Let's not dwell.
All right. Yeah, let's go back.
Let's find some other bad news to talk about.
313-298-WRIF, and I fixed my phones myself. How about that?
Good job, Peter.
Yeah. Here's Jeff from Westland. Jeff, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, Peter. Julian.
Hello.
Hi.
How you guys doing?
Doing great. How are you?
Excellent. Hey, well, I was just calling about what was going on with the healthcare reform.
Sure.
And what's your stance on it? Do you think that's a good idea? Because I'm down for it. I make $9.50 an hour, and if I have to pay 85% of my taxes, so like if something happens to me, I kind of like that to be taken care of. You know?
Yeah. Well, every other industrialized country in the world has something similar to universal health care paid for by the government. And in the main, it works well. I mean, are there any glitches? Are there any problems? Of course. I mean, it's a system. It's a bureaucracy, whether it's in Canada or England or Italy or France or Denmark or Japan or wherever. But there's also a massive bureaucracy that dwarfs anything in the other countries and is so expensive. I was reading these figures earlier. About a third of it goes to administration. And then it's a for-profit system. Of course, there's a big chunk of it has to go for that as well. So it really taps out employers. And even when you are fortunate enough to have health care, like through your company, like I do, I still have to pay probably $2,500 a year, plus co-pays every time I go to a doctor, plus every time I get any prescriptions.
I got to tell you something. I'd give anything for that deal.
No, I know. I know. Well, there's a lack of fairness here since we've worked for the same employer, we know. But
I don't know.
Is anybody listening to this? Hope.
Well, I don't know. Have you guys ever watched that movie, Sicko? But I'm sure you're not big Michael Moore fans.
Wow, we're huge Michael Moore fans.
He's our buddy.
That movie was awesome, and I watched that, and I was so pissed. And I was like, if they can do it in like Switzerland or whatever, I mean, why can't they figure out how to do it here? Then. Before you cut me off, Sarah Palin's a D-bag.
Oh, we could go on all night about her.
We could indeed. All right,
list of
Jeff,
names.
Thank you very much. Some open lines were at 313-298-WRIF. And the idea that, I mean, the arguments that have been going on for the last 50 or 60 years in this country against universal health care have generally been by people that don't need health, that don't need government health care. I mean, that that either have enough money on their own or have some ideological, you know, it's not, it's called ideological, but it normally is just, it has to do with their wealth. I mean, all these right-wingers and conservatives that have always been against it, they're just tied in with the big pharmaceuticals, with the AMA, with the big hospital chains and all that. So why take them seriously? Medical bills prompt more than 60% of U.S. bankruptcies. You know how many medical bills prompt percentage-wise in Canada? Zero.
Oh, yeah.
You know how many in England? Zero. You know how many in Denmark? Zero. You know how many in Japan? Zero. Yet here, that the onus of this extraordinarily expensive and necessary system is thrown back upon employers, which sometimes, I mean, sometimes they can't even afford good health care. And the other time, and but also it's such an enormous cost, they have to always fight to keep it as low as possible and giving as little service as possible.
Yeah.
Because everything more they allow, their generosity can turn into millions of dollars for them if they're a big employer.
Oh, yeah.
And I never understood why the car companies, like right now, aren't leading the charge for universal single-payer health care.
Yeah, true. Gosh.
Justice. These 17, 18, 19-year-old football players in County in Pennsylvania on a figured that they dislike illegal immigrants so much that they was, and I stress, was Luis Ramirez, and they beat him to death.
No.
And they were all happy to show you they got
in there for
years of simple assault in the beating death of an illegal Mexican immigrant.
That's horrible.
Yeah. And the judge was stuck because it wasn't so much, you know, this is this little article about it, but the judge was stuck. He said he could not consider the racial overtone of the case. Consider that.
What?
Because the.
Because of the.
The charge was simple assault. And.
Simple assault. And death.
Yeah. Both teenagers who were high school football players were acquitted by an all-white jury of ethnic intimidation.
Oh, boy.
They kill an illegal Mexican immigrant, and they're cleared of ethnic intimidation. This sounds like Alabama or Mississippi, 1955.
Sure does. Sure does.
Also, one of the teenagers, Brandon Piskarski, was acquitted of third-degree murder.
Oh, really?
I don't understand this.
Yeah, I don't get it either.
I don't get it.
And I wonder what kind of homes they came from, you know, where they got these ideas in the first place.
Here, this is probably going to surprise you that I'm coming down on the side of this, but the Michigan Supreme Court voted to give judges authority over how witnesses dress. This follows a Muslim woman who refused to remove her veil while testifying in a small claims case.
Right, but it wasn't even a veil. It was the whole
thing. All you could see
know,
was her eyes. I don't even know if you could see her eyes.
In the picture, I saw you could, barely.
Okay. I mean, how do you know it was her?
Well, yeah, but yeah. I mean, come on, Peter.
Well, I mean, that's part of the problem. A statewide rule letting judges regulate the appearance of witnesses, including asking them to remove face coverings, was approved by a 5-2 vote by the Michigan Supreme Court.
Kind of like fingerprinting or something.
Yeah, okay. The two dissenters said there should be an exception for people whose clothing is dictated by their religion. The woman, Gina Muhammad, sued because her case was dismissed when she refused to remove her veil in a Hamtramck court. The judge in the case, Paul Perrick, told Ms. Muhammad he needed to see her face to assess her truthfulness. I mean, how would you like to be facing a masked person?
Well, how would you like to be the masked person?
Well,
I mean, really?
This is the United States. She has, you know.
Yeah, it's different. But, you know, I mean, first of all, how long has she been here? And if she did that in, where is she from?
I think, if I remember right, I think she's African-American.
Oh, she is. Okay.
I believe so.
Okay.
And, you know, there's...
Because women are killed for showing their...
In Iran, in Iraq.
Right.
Not in the United States.
Right. But shunned by their family.
Yeah. The card rule gives judges reasonable control over the appearances of parties or witnesses to observe their demeanor and ensure that they can be accurately identified.
Now, I don't know.
See, what I don't think people that have this religious prohibition on, on showing a woman her face, and I mean, this is why they're so, all these religions are so whacked out about sex and everything. That's what's all about. You can't have it both ways. You can't veil women and then have them represent themselves. Women do not have representation in societies in which they are veiled. The men, they stay at home. The men represent them.
Oh yeah.
So
sounds like hell to me.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody want to take the side of the masked woman? Anybody think that, yeah, we ought to give some special credence to someone who has religious beliefs that forbid them? Hey, don't bring small claims then. That's what I'd say.
Oh, Peter.
313-298-WRIF. I don't believe, listen, I don't know. I wonder about the constitutionality of it, because the First Amendment says that Congress shall make no law establishing religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof.
And that is her exercise thereof.
I don't know.
Good question.
You know,
Peter Werby's baffled.
Yeah. doesn't that mean a lot to you? Don't you, if you're trying to figure something out, don't you, you look at the person's demeanor. You look at their face. I mean, do they look nervous? Are their eyes
getting
strong?
Well, then let's go, let's say that at poker tournaments you can't wear sunglasses then.
Okay.
Come on.
All right. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Aaron Ahrens in Chesterfield Township. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Thank you, Peter. Appreciate it. Listen, I'm kicking myself in the head right now because I can't remember what it's called. Go figure. But the actual origin of, the auto companies supplying health care to their workers occurred during World War II. It was... Jeez, and I'm killing myself right now because I can't.
Well, just don't kick yourself in the head.
Don't kill and don't kick.
Kick yourself in the butt, but don't kick yourself in the head.
Figuratively, in hyperbole, I'm kicking. I can't remember, but FDR actually issued an executive order, which, one of thousands during World War II, but it was prohibiting most companies from supplying skilled labor with higher wages during that time. So as an alternative, they turned to health insurance coverage.
Ah. Yeah, because there were wage freezes.
Supplemental benefit.
Yeah.
So what happened was that actually boomed. Healthcare coverage was super cheap, increased massively, exponentially, I think, during that time. But as soon as the war was over and they got back to really looking at these things, they pulled it back quite a bit until the IRS was able to codify taxes.
Now, Harry Truman,
for this health insurance. It's only gotten worse, really. But the auto industry. That was actually, that was a big plus, but it's really, it all comes down to the government.
Mm-hmm. Well, 1946 or 1947, England began I don't know if they were the first. I wonder about that. But England had and think about how badly England was damaged physically and the treasury that was expended. United States, that's when the economy expanded. That's when we became committed to a permanent war economy. After the war, we thought, whoa, wait a minute. We came out of the Depression solely because of all the expenditures for World War II. This was socialism. This was the cost of the war was socialized. We paid taxes and then it was transferred into the war production and war fighting. There was kind of some couple nasty enemies out there. And then all of a sudden World War II ended and they thought, oh, what are we going to do? We can't spend billions and billions and billions of dollars anymore because we don't have an enemy any longer. Joe Stalin, hello. Then the evil empire, communism, was going to take over the world and was going to march into Western Europe and take over the United States and all that. So they were conveniently, and I stress this, if you disagree, please call me, they were invented as the enemy of the United States in the necessitated this continuing enormous expenditure of money, and that what became the permanent military-industrial complex. That, in many ways, didn't leave a lot of money for things like health care, but England managed to do it. England in 1946, 1947, with a Labour government, put in their national health program that they still have today, and at one point, Harry Truman, the president from 1945 to 1952, I guess, suggested, and the American Medical Association, these very, very conservative doctors tied into the for-profit hospitals and the pharmaceuticals even then, said this is socialized medicine. And socialized medicine, socialism then, was akin to support for our enemy, the Soviet Union, so that collapsed. And in the meantime, we've been paying our own ever since.
Peter got an email from Jim in East Point and said, I love you guys, and the show is awesome, but you are driving me crazy. I've never heard you defend a politician in the way you're defending Obama. I, too, supported the president, but lately I'm very disappointed with him. He may not have promised a cure for cancer, but he did pledge close to the equivalent. Isn't 6 months long enough to do something for us? I say no. Why can't he just push stuff through like Bush did? Bush didn't give a crap about consensus. Obama could do the same thing, except it would actually be stuff to help us. Doesn't he still have the super presidential powers that Bush had? And then he says, keep up the great work.
Well,
thanks.
And what was his first name? I'm sorry.
Jim. In East Point.
Actually, after the midnight break, I will be critical of Barack Obama.
All right.
And talk about people, some email that I've gotten of people that are critical of Barack Obama. And I don't know why he was thinking that. I know what he was saying. I was saying that he was functioning with. Here's what I was doing, Jim. I was trying to say that Barack Obama is operating within the political space that's available. And that is oriented towards the elite of this society, the elite institutions, the financial institutions, the political institutions, everything, the medical institutions, all of that. And he's not going to go, and he's not going to be able to go outside of it, and he's not going to do so unless we create the political space. I mean, Lyndon Baines Johnson was a guy that got elected, remember, you know, the president, that got elected in 1964. He came from a state where segregation still was in force. But because of a civil rights movement, he was, because the public space opened both in the South and in the North, the clamor for equal rights for everybody in this country was such that it existed, the public space, the political space I'm talking about. If you're just hoping that Barack Obama is going to move outside of the consensus, the elite consensus that rules this country, you can keep on hoping. But and we can hope that we've gotten a better deal already. I mean, it would have been horrible to have. I mean, can you imagine Sarah Palin being the vice president? Oh,
no,
man.
No.
That is a stick in the eye.
Yeah.
All right, let me get
a stick up the you-know-what.
Yeah. Here's Gary and Warren. Gary, hi. It's Peter and Jalene.
Yeah, how you doing? I just want to make a comment about the woman in court.
Yeah, with the fully covered.
Yes. Basically, in my opinion, she has to take that off. You're supposed to have separation from, you know, church and state. The church has to be any type of religion,
sure,
regardless if it's Christian or Muslim or whatever else. So I believe that she has to take.
Well, you got to make some compromises. Either if you want to be in the justice system, you'll have to follow the current rules, or if you want to keep wearing your chadar or whatever they call it in a particular instant, you know, the full woman fully covered, then they can't take advantage of the justice system. I mean, it's one or the other. Did I say
agree.
That right?
Julie, I agree. Think so.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I'm sorry. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Let me see. How many? Okay. We should do this. We'll be back to criticize Barack Obama right after
Ooh.
This. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And there are some open lines as well.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
What do you guys
want to
do? We have the
whole thing. All this weekend, 101 The Rim is blowing out your free tickets for Chicken Foot. Sammy Hagar, Joe Satriani, Michael Anthony, Chad Smith. Listen for your chance to win tickets for Chicken Foot. August 8th at the Fillmore Detroit. One lucky winner will score the grand prize. A guitar autographed by the band. Tickets available exclusively at Revivation.com. The Rim's Ticket Flow. blowout weekend.
Listen and win.
From 101 WRIF, everything that rocks. 101 WRIF, streaming worldwide at WRIF.com. The Riff wants to know how we can improve your iPhone 3G experience. We hope you'll take a brief survey at WRIF.com/iPhone and tell us how you can use your iPhone 3G. Thanks again for listening at WRIF.com.
If your credit card debt has gotten out of control, if you're over your head at monthly payments, here's one powerful secret the credit card companies don't want you to know. You have the right to settle your credit card debt for a fraction of what you owe, allowing you to cut your debt up to half or more. That's bad news for credit card companies, but it's great news for you. We're Consumer Debt Advocate, and we'd like to offer you a free consultation that will help you start eliminating credit card debt. For your free consultation that will set you free, call 1-800-984-6953. Don't ruin your credit by declaring bankruptcy. Settle your debt and move on with your life. During your free consultation, you'll find out what the credit card companies don't want you to know. For your free consultation that will help you settle your credit card debt for a fraction of what you owe, call today. The number is 1-800-984-6953. 1-800-984-6953.
Attention! Hydralyze is currently seeking participants with dark circles and puffy eyes. If you have dark circles or bags around your eyes due to heredity, fatigue, or aging, you are eligible to see results and participate in the Hydralyze trial. Hydralyze was introduced to improve delicate skin around the eyes and now has been shown to eliminate dark circles and bags. It effectively diminishes even dark circles caused by heredity. To participate in the Hydralyze trial and see results risk-free, call 1-800-505-7931. Fragile capillaries around the eye can leak, allowing blood to pool beneath the skin like an ugly bruise. But right now, you can join the thousands of people who have seen their dark circles fade away, watched as bags literally disappeared from view. Participate in the free trial by calling today. If you're serious about getting rid of your dark circles or bags around the eyes, you are eligible to participate and experience results with Hydralyze. Call this number today, 1-800-505-7931. Once more, that's 1-800-505-7931.
Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Line scale deposits block the heating element, which cost you up to 25% more. That's an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove line scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy. With HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents line scale buildup in your entire plumbing system, guaranteed. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances and save money with HydraCare. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. Lower your energy costs. Visit bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com.
Do you know the fastest way to learn a new language?
Memorization?
We always did translation.
Is it drills?
The world's fastest, easiest way to learn a new language is Rosetta Stone software. It doesn't waste your time with tedious translation, useless memorization, or boring drills. Instead, it teaches you a new language the same way you learned your first language. And right now, you can experience it for yourself because Rosetta Stone is offering a free demo CD-ROM. Check out the easiest, fastest way to learn the language of your choice. For the free CD-ROM, call 1-800-337-1442. Discover what U.S. diplomats, NASA, and over 10,000 schools already know, that this is the world's fastest, easiest way to learn a language, guaranteed. Choose from 31 languages and request your free CD-ROM today. You'll be amazed at what you learn. Just call 1-800-337-1442. Request your free CD-ROM from Rosetta Stone by calling 1-800-337-1442. That's 1-800-337-1442.
Please stay tuned to the following public announcement. The government and private banks are liquidating houses now. These houses have been foreclosed, confiscated, or repossessed, and will be sold. Homes may be sold for very little money down. To learn how to receive a free list of foreclosures, call 800-354-8211. All listeners whose last name begins with the letter A through N are allowed to start calling now. Listeners whose last name begins with O through Z can begin calling tomorrow, 9 a.m. Every house must be sold. The government and banks are very motivated to sell these homes quickly, so listings may not always remain available in all areas. So act now. I repeat, this is a public announcement. All listeners whose last name begins with the letter A through N can start calling now. Listeners whose last name begins with O through Z can begin calling tomorrow, 9 a.m. Call CRN's national toll-free hotline to learn how to receive your free foreclosure list at 800-354-8211. That's 800-354-8211.
Time's running out. You're maxed out on your credit cards. The collection calls are coming every day, and now you're two payments behind on your mortgage. Every time you turn on the radio, there's some cheerful couple telling you how they got out of debt overnight. Their stress is gone, and everything's just wonderful. Come on. The truth is, what sounds too good to be true is too good to be true. You need real help, and you need it now. Not bankruptcy. That should be your last choice. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're the only attorney-driven program dedicated to helping you get out of debt in months instead of years, saving you thousands, and without risking your family home. We know what we're doing, and we don't make promises we can't keep. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Get out of debt. Call Credit Card Relief at 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282.
101.1 WRIF in WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Jaleen. You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour of Night Call. I'm Peter Werby. Jaleen Jordan is with me. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. My website is Peter Werby, WERBE.com. Lots of interesting stuff on that. We'll have guests at 1 a.m. that I've interviewed earlier. We have a MySpace page. We have a Facebook page. There'll be a podcast of this program available by noon on Tuesday. All right. Let's see. Roger, who you reach when you call 313-298-WRIF. We're talking about national health insurance. One problem could be waiting for procedures. Roger, that is another one of the, I don't know if it's a myth exactly, but one of the arguments against government paid for health care. That in some cases in Canada, that you have to wait longer than you would here if you have the proper health insurance.
But if you're, like, bleeding out, they're going to take care of you.
Of course.
You know?
50 million people in this country don't have any health insurance whatsoever, so they're waiting a long time for procedures.
Absolutely.
Right? And the other thing is, the only reason in any country that there's not, the absolute best health care imaginable is because of costs. Like I've said 100 times before, Canada wastes billions and billions of dollars on its armed forces, which it doesn't need at all.
Yeah, true.
Remember? What do I always say? The only country that's ever going to invade Canada is the United States.
Yeah, so, I don't see it happening.
Yeah. Well, there was a case back in the 70s that they threw onto the table, the contingency plans that exist. The United States has contingency plans for the invasion of occupation of every country in the world, particularly Canada and particularly Mexico. I'm not saying that there's this deep conspiracy that at one point they're going to say, okay, now we're going to invade Canada and occupy it and make it our 51st state. It means that all contingencies are planned for. That if somehow like China started doing what the United States is doing in Asia and in the Middle East, like, for instance, say the Chinese started suppressing some uprising in Canada. There was Chinese troops in Canada, right?
Right.
Yeah. And you say, boy, is that ridiculous? Well, I wonder what the Iranians think about the United States having troops in countries on both sides of them. They're probably not real happy about that. In any event, the United States doesn't want to have to say, okay, we better figure out where's Saskatchewan, and what's the prime minister's name? You know, is it still Muldoon? We were going to talk about Obama. Obama poll sees doubt on budget and health care. People still have this great personal affection for Obama, although it's dropping among Republicans. But let's see. His rating has fallen to 23% among Republicans from 44% in February. People who identified themselves as Republicans in February, 44% of them gave approval ratings to Barack Obama.
Wow.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it sure is.
Majority of people said his economic policies have had either no effect yet on improving the economy or have made it worse, underscoring how his political strength still rests on faith in his leadership rather than concrete results. They found that support for his plans to overhaul health care, rescue the auto industry, and close the prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, falls well below his job approval ratings. Now, Obama, this is an article in CommonDreams.org by Dave Lindorf, who I've interviewed any number of times before. CommonDreams.org is where it appears. Obama's health reform Waterloo. Waterloo is where Napoleon was defeated, and they say somebody meets his Waterloo. And he says, because Obama and congressional Democrats are unwilling to cut themselves off from the lucrative campaign funding bonanza that is the health care industry, they cannot address seriously either the cost or the access crisis that plagues health care in the United States and that makes health care in this country cost 20% of the gross GDP, which is gross. Why can't I think of it all?
Domestic product.
Product. Twice that cost in any other modern nation on a per capita or GDP basis. And it still leaves 1 in 6 Americans without ready access to even routine health care. The answer to this crisis is obvious. A single-payer, socialized system in which you still have private doctors in privacy and private or publicly run hospitals, but where the government sets the payment rates for treatment and provides all compensation to health care providers.
Mm.
They wouldn't be able to do, you know, quite the deal. People aren't very happy with him because although President Obama has extended benefits to same-sex partners of federal employees, that the new policy does not include health and retirement benefits which heterosexual married employees receive. Mm-hmm. That has to do with DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. I don't get that. They want to defend marriage, and then they're trying to stop hundreds and thousands of couples that want to get married. Oh, yeah, they're the same sex. And
crazy homosexuals.
Yeah, those homos. Yeah, homo. Yeah. Yeah. Why do they have homo milk? I haven't done that in a long time.
Right.
You know, they don't, you know, milk is homogenized and pasteurized.
Listen,
they
say, you homophobes, you're drinking homo milk.
You're drinking homo milk. Why do they don't say anything like pasto milk? It's homo milk. But anyway,
we're stretching a bit, we admit it.
Obama would have to really go up against the Defense of Marriage Act, and certainly the Democrats don't have the courage for that. The political space, again, may not be there. And right now, Barack Obama, I think he is a, you know, some of my really rad friends are going to say, man, you've gotten so conservative. I think Barack Obama is a basically decent guy. He operates within the matrix of what exists, which means he's not going to go too far out for anything. He wants to maintain the Democrats in power and wants to extend the majority that they have. He's not going to go up against the Defense of Marriage Act, And what does that show, a lack of political courage, or does it show political realism, or what? Or lack of political leadership? Any of that. Let's see, what else is in here? The eavesdropping continues, as does other secrecy programs from the Bush administration. Bush's wars continue. Bush's economic bailouts continue. That apparently the country is learning about how the federal government has been exceeding its legal authority and violating Americans' most basic rights in the name of fighting terrorism. In a disturbing article in the New York Times, the authors said that the congressional investigation suggested the National Security Agency under Barack Obama continues to routinely collect Americans' telephone calls and email messages, perhaps by the millions. So you're saying, why the hell did we vote for this guy? Because he is a hell of a lot different than that pack of illegal, incompetent, mean-spirited greed heads that typified the Bush regime, the illegal Bush regime. That's why. I mean, there are any number of good things that have already occurred, a lot of it around the edges, but it is so nice not to have to see somebody like John McCain and, worst of all, Sarah Palin every day. And so, again, if we want more
out of fear, listen to her.
Yeah. If we want more out of Barack Obama, we have to be the ones to create him. We have to create the expanded Barack Obama. I mean, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a wealthy man, was considered a traitor to his class, the ruling class, the ruling elite. They're saying, what are you doing? You're letting, trade unions didn't have federal recognition. They passed the Wagner Act. He passed Social Security, and, man, they went crazy. The conservatives did. They didn't want anybody to, just because they got old and didn't have a job, to get any money from the government. That was socialism. And they didn't want people to have weekends off. They didn't want to have a minimum wage. I can't even remember all the things that they fought against. And the reason that Franklin Delano Roosevelt did this, he seemed like, from everything I've ever read, a decent person. But millions of people active in their communities and in their unions and their churches and everywhere else created the political space. And they said, it's either reform or revolution. That was part of it. And the smarter ones in the ruling class, the smarter capitalists said, "Whoa, we better have some reform here. We don't want to do this revolution thing." Here's another. This is a headline. I won't even go into it too much. But Obama invokes Jesus more than Bush.
I saw that. And who wrote it?
Eamon Javers.
From what publication?
Politico. Which is sometimes kind of right. But, I take it for him.
He loves himself some Jesus.
The only time I remember Jesus Christ being mentioned in my home is when my dad fell down the basement stairs one time. Actually, that's not true. Up until I was about 6 or 7 years old, I thought that was my name.
Oh, I've heard this one.
Every time I walked through the door, my dad would say,
Peter.
You know, who's the comedian?
I can't remember which one.
You know, the guy that had the family show on television. Bill Cosby. Yeah. That was his. Yeah, that was his. Here's what could very well happen, though. So people beginning to doubt Obama. They expected everything was so bad. They knew that that McCain and Palin were not just Bush 2. Some people have said that Barack Obama is Bush Light, or, you know, we could talk about that a lot, too. But it was essentially a referendum. Did you think the last 8 years of war, malfeasance, torture, secrecy, all Enron, every bit of it, was that a good thing? If you thought that was good, Halliburton, right. If you thought all of that was a good thing, Dick Cheney, that whole cast of characters, if you thought that was a real good thing, then vote for McCain and Palin. So that was rejected, and well that it was.
Whew.
Yeah. Now, I must have another pile here. Because what I was talking about was that people now are thinking, like I said earlier, whoa, he did not solve all the country's programs and problems yet. He didn't put the programs in that would solve the problems. And I got an email here. I hope that I can find it. It's gone. Anyways, it was someone who says we essentially... Oh, no, here it is. Here it is. This isn't a night call. This is from Stan. Stan says he had to leave his home state, Michigan, move to the South for a couple of years. And he says, I came home to a depression. He says, I blame 99.9% of this destruction on Bushco. But in the light of the blame and anger and frustration, the love, the hate, the sacrifice, I feel stabbed in the back literally by the new administration in Washington, D.C. So the anger is already beginning to be transmitted from Bush, who created this, to Barack Obama, who hasn't immediately solved all this.
People need someone to blame.
Well, also, some people will say, well, look, it's not even been 6 months,
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So, This is quite a long piece, but he says, as far as President Obama goes, myself and a lot of friends and family feel betrayed and stabbed in the back by this president. He promised and swore an oath to defend the country and has sold it out. So, and he doesn't like the idea that that Chrysler and General Motors are being dictated to. I don't know. I'll tell you, Stan, I don't know what the options were for this. Again, you have these enormous institutions, and they either had to be dismantled and turned over to committees of the workers or something like that, or go at it like this. I don't know how else. I mean, some of these right-wing nut jobs have just said, let them all go bankrupt. The hell with it, you know?
Right.
That's the correction. They always talk about Wall Street doing the correction. Well, it says here that conservatives are the single largest ideological group in the country, that a full 40% of Americans interviewed by the National Gallup poll surveys describe their political views as conservative, 35% as moderate, 21% as liberal. So moderate and liberal is 56%, to be sure. So that is good. But, you know, part of it is, you know, you say to somebody, oh, yeah, I'm a conservative. You know, yeah, I'm a conservative. They say, well, are you for a single-payer national health plan? 72% of the people say, yeah. Do you think that the, I mean, you go down a list of
issues,
and you go, hey, every one of these, not only is liberal, you know, half of them are leftists. So I don't know how people sell. I mean, there are some hardcore ideological right-wingers that are that call themselves conservatives, but I suspect that that's probably a lot less than 40%. You know, I always talk about a third or 25% of the country being the fascist right. And they're not fascists now. I don't mean that they're, you know, running around saying, you know, Heil to the leader or anything like that. But when, you know, the conservatives throughout European history and some Asian countries, the conservatives always supported the fascists. Always supported the fascists. The communists, you'd say, well, what about the communists and the liberals? Whenever the communists came to power, they always off the liberals right away. The liberals were always the enemy. Of the communists. All right, so
did we do a good enough job?
I think it was pretty scattered. The point being that it's got to be you and I and everyone listening that are going to create change in this country. If you're just hoping that Barack Obama will, well, we can hope, and he is better than a stick in the eye, and John McCain and Sarah Palin were a definite stick, in fact, in both eyes. Okay. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Here is Ron in Detroit. Hi, Ron. You're on with Peter and Jolene.
Yeah, Peter, well, you do sound pretty conservative. So is everything over at Air America and Ed Schultz, too. So let me give you two examples where you really got to get over your Milton Friedman economics and move to a really...
You know, wait a minute. I just kind of cut you off a second. What are you talking about, man? I am not into any... Ron, the Milton Friedman, for people that don't know, in the Chicago school... Where we had this view of the market economy would fix everything. When it was exported to places like Chile, it became fascism. So the idea that somehow you would identify anything that I'm saying with Milton Friedman either means you don't understand what his economics were, or I just haven't made myself clear. Go ahead.
Do you know the work of Alan Brown?
No.
Well, that's part of your problem.
Okay, I'm sure.
Oh, Peter,
I knew Alan Brown.
Now we know.
Yeah, I know a couple Alans.
I think it's Alan.
America has been interviewed by your buddy Tom Hartman. Richard Green has had her on twice. So don't sit there and disparage her. You've got a lot to learn.
Oh, it's a her, Ellen, not Alan. Alan.
We don't even know who. How can we disparage someone we don't even know who the hell she is?
Webofdebt.com, and I'll tell you why you're wrong. Because Ellen Brown explains that just as Abraham Lincoln did, and just as the colonists did with their Continental, there is no need whatsoever to raise taxes to pay for health care. It's a phony issue, and you held...
Well, wait a minute. What made you think I think they ought to raise taxes in order to fund health care?
Contributions.
What's that?
Okay, now let's talk about how this...
Wait, no. What makes you think that I want to raise taxes on the average person? I want to have huge taxes on the ultra wealthy to bring their wealth way down, you know, free up some of that that impacted wealth that they control. That the only thing it does is buy government. But it, you know, are you sure? I don't know. Maybe you haven't been listening. Maybe you listen to talk radio too much.
Peter, am I still on?
Yeah, you're still on, but you're off.
No,
you're so far wear off. I don't know what to say.
You're listening to me because you want to talk over me because I'm saying something that's so...
Well, you know what? I'm just going to talk over you. That, you know,
you're kind of angry, yeah, and it's not helping things.
Let's go back. Let's go back to a few things. Why would you... And I'm going to let you talk in a minute. Right now, you could be screaming at the top of your lungs and no one could hear you because you're on a fader and that's completely down. Now, why do you think I'm associated with this failed economic policy, this two-part question, failed economic policies of the far-right wing identified around the Chicago school, typified by Milton Friedman? And the second thing is, where did you ever get the idea that I wanted to raise taxes to pay for a universal single-payer health care?
The president that you are supporting, and by the way, I certainly do not support him. He is a neoliberal, as Ralph Nader correctly identified it shortly after the election in his article up at Counterpunch, something you should have looked at.
Oh, Ron, you know what? You give me a pain in the ass. I'm not even going to bother with you anymore. Write me an email or something like that.
He was ready for you, firing all guns there, Peter. But
did he answer my question? Either my questions?
No. He went into his own
thing. Here's the way we fund almost everything. You take the military budget when everything is said and done. The military-industrial complex, cut it by 3/4. We can cut the military budget by 3/4, so it's like $250 billion, which is probably way still too much for our authentic defense needs. And you have $750 billion a year then to do other things with. And it's clear I'm a right winger because I'm quoting Ron Paul, who says, take back all the bases. They're saying the 30,000 troops in Korea are on high alert because of what's happening in North Korea. Why do we have 30,000 troops in Korea? This is something from half a century ago.
You know what, Peter? It's just to me... I'm really baffled by this whole anyone thinking that you're conservative at all.
I don't know what the hell this guy was talking
about. Wow.
And I don't know why he thinks I was giving Barack Obama a free pass after I was just absolutely critical of him and said that most of what he's doing is just continuation of politics and economics as usual. And the only way that we're going to alter that is by taking things, we the people, taking things into our own hands. And he was just your buddy, Tom Hartman. And all.
Ron's obviously not listening.
Yeah, Ron. Write me an email. Okay, just send it off to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. A short one, which
right
I don't
away.
Know if you're capable of. Here's Douglas in Ferndale. Doug, you want to talk about that Hamtramck court case with the woman with the chadar, the full coverage?
Yeah, I did.
Go ahead.
The First Amendment may give you the right to practice your own religion, but it doesn't give you the right to impose your religion on all the rest of us. And, you know, look at the defendant's point of view. Doesn't the defendant have a right to face his accuser in court?
Sure.
Well, I don't understand why...
I think the judge did exactly the right thing by dismissing it. And I think it was pretty stupid of somebody to try to show up in court in a cloak where you couldn't be faced and couldn't be identified and try to pursue a case.
Yeah, you know, what if this woman was going to go home and get beat by her husband because she took that off? Honestly, think about it.
Well, that's a fundamental problem with religion. That's not a problem with our court system.
I agree. Yeah, I mean, if she's, it's like I said, if she is going to take that ultimate submissive role and even hide herself completely from public view, she should have the man in her family do the advocacy in terms of that tradition she's working out of.
We should put some limits on religious violence is what we should do. But from the perspective of the court, that was perfectly appropriate for the judge to dismiss the case.
I agree.
And to bring in all these other problems of religion is really not what the court was doing. The court came in, they were presented with a case that could not reasonably be pursued, and the judge dismissed it.
You know, it's illegal to go masked in public. I don't know if there's an exception in the law for religious stuff now, but you just can't put on like a mask and go walking around in public because usually it's a sign of malintent, right?
Or Mardi Gras.
Yeah, well, you know what? The exception was to the old, I don't know if it's still law, was Halloween. Okay. Thank you very much, Douglas, for your opinion. Can you Can you see if you can Google that? Michigan law masked in public. I don't know if anything will come up.
Wish me luck.
With that. Let's see. Here's Chris in Detroit. Hi, Chris. It's Peter and Jalene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Peter. Thank you very much. Really enjoying the conversation. I'm going to kind of stumble across this. It's a very lively conversation.
Thank you.
We're looking for somebody to kind of take the advocacy of this this poor woman with the veil.
Sure. Go ahead.
And, you know, I don't understand her religion fully, and I think that's been a big problem in America, especially when you think back on 9/11, is our lack of understanding of where folks of other ethnicities are coming from. And, you know, for all we know, her to remove that mask might be like you and me being asked to go to court and take our pants off.
Well, it could very well
See,
be, but she
you.
But she has two choices then, either to remain faithful to her, pardon me, to her religion, or to for me to start choking again. This is the choking hour for me always. Pardon me. Or to participate in the justice system as it's currently situated. You could say, well, can't we make some accommodation? Isn't this about inclusiveness? We don't want outsiders in this society. We want everyone included in the body politic to share equally in its institutions, its rights, its responsibilities, and what have you. But you know, justice is very, very specific. And this was a small claims thing, and I forgot the circumstances. This article doesn't have it. But say somebody was suing me, and the plaintiff comes completely covered except for her eyes. And I'm thinking, how can anybody even tell what, I mean, is she looking nervous? Is she, you know, I mean, we put in our culture big, and I'm sure probably most cultures do, big emphasis on the demeanor of somebody. And that's what the court said. She is masked from view when in a courtroom we want everything to be explicit.
Sometimes we do. Other times what we do is we give the judges some leeway and we say, you know what, this isn't suitable for everybody to see, but let the judge see.
Well,
and I wonder if we could make some sort of compromise like that so that, you know, she'd be able to protect, you know, what's dear to her, and at the same time, judicial process can be carried out. I mean,
yeah.
That says, you know what, the judge is going to take a look and we're make sure that's the right person without, you know, really stirring up a foment that, you know, we as Americans have been quick to do. Hey, let's jump in. That's a person's religion. Let's stomp on it without knowing that that's what we're doing. We do it in the name of our understanding of justice. And is that really the other person? So, I just wonder if there's a compromise.
Oh, I hear you. And that's what the two dissenting Michigan Supreme Court justices said, that there ought to be some way that they ought to compromise in the idea that if somebody's required by their religion. But we live in a secular society, and for instance, in some countries like France and in Turkey, as an example, that have had bad histories of religious strife, they don't allow any expression of public religiosity, like wearing big crosses or yarmulkes for observant Jews or anything like that, if you're going into public institutions. You know, Muslim women can't wear headscarves in schools and what have you. And the idea, and there's big movements among all of these people. Hey, I want to be able to wear my cross. I want to be able to wear my headscarf. But I don't like the idea of officialdom telling you what you can wear and how you can express yourself. On the other hand, religion has such a bad history of strife and of distorting secular societies that it really stretches my tolerance, I'll tell you.
Well, I don't think the solution to bad religion is no religion. I think the solution to bad religion is good religion, because I think when we look at the bright side of what, you know, our traditional faith traditions have, belief systems have been able to do, hospitals, Salvation Army, I mean,
the Inquisition.
You know, there are a lot of good things that religion at its best can do, and I'm not sure that banning it is the way to go to come up with a totally secular society. Our country is set up with the fundamental understanding that religion, I mean, it helps culture. I mean, why else do churches not pay taxes and we give a break, you know, at housing to clergy people and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think that's unconstitutional, to tell you the truth. But whatever. Let's see if we can get some more opinion. I appreciate your comments, Chris.
Hey, and
appreciate your show, Peter. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. All right, if you got more to say on that, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743. I'm not really finding anything other than old laws that had to do with the KKK.
That you can't go masked in public.
Right.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, why couldn't... Well, you could say that. Why can't someone be masked like the Ku Klux Klan, walk down the street?
Can you imagine?
Well, you might say, well, why not? You know, it's...
Is there a law against spitting on someone?
I don't know.
That's what I do.
All right, so according to the Gallup poll, conservatives are the single largest ideological group. But I say that if you would question people by issues, you'd find that the liberal left view really comes out predominant. But let's talk a little about conservatives and conservatism when we come back. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, hang on.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
The future is here. We do not need to be afraid anymore.
From your iPhone 3G, download the free WRIF app in the iTunes Store. It gives you one-touch access to WRIF streaming live wherever you are. For more details at WRIF.com.
The Riff. The international record labels are asking Congress for a handout, and they want to take it from your local radio stations. That may mean stations like this one have to cut back on the music we play or the community services we provide. Representative Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick and Sandra Levin can help by sponsoring a bill to keep the radio you love free from a performance tax. Call today and ask them to sponsor the Local Radio Freedom Act and oppose a performance tax on free radio. And thank you to Representative Candace Miller for her support of free radio. Learn more at noperformancetax.org. This message furnished by the NAB and this station.
I looked at her and I was just, wow, she looked so young.
I told her I couldn't believe how smooth her face looks. She's lost, what, 10 years at least?
I look at her and it's like I'm looking at a picture of my wife from 20 years ago. It's incredible.
How are ordinary women across America looking years younger? They've discovered the proven breakthrough called Hydroxytone. It erases wrinkles, tightens skin, and makes frown lines disappear from view. See for yourself by requesting a free trial of Hydroxytone today. The results are so impressive. Hydroxytone was given away in VIP gift bags at international film festivals. Try Hydroxytone risk-free and shed years from your appearance faster than you thought possible.
She always looked good to me, but now I can't believe how young she looks.
Call now for your free trial of Hydroxytone. For a limited time, try it before you buy it. 1-800-630-3327. But hurry, when this offer's gone, it's gone. Call 1-800-630-3327. 1-800-630-3327.
You may have seen her on Oprah or The View. We're talking to Lucinda Bassett, founder of the Midwest Center, about a powerful free tape she's giving away to help people discover a way to leave anxiety and depression behind for good. Lucinda, what are some of the symptoms of anxiety?
Worry, fear, depression, insecurity, low self-esteem. I suffered with anxiety and depression for over 20 years. When I was at my lowest point, I was curled up in a ball on my living room sofa, afraid to live and afraid to die.
Wow. So what's the biggest anxiety myth?
I think the most challenging thing about working with people with anxiety and depression is that many of them think they're victims of their emotions. They think they'll always be worrisome, fearful, and depressed.
But that's not true.
There's real drug-free help that has the potential to last a lifetime. Millions of people have called for this wonderful free tape.
Okay. To request your free tape, call 1-800-550-6146. 1-800-550-6146. 1-800-550-6146.
Here's more Direct Talk from DirecTV. Today, we're talking stimulus, specifically great TV at a great price kind of stimulus. With DirecTV, enjoy 100% digital picture and sound, including most sports, the greatest movies, and all your local channels. Packages start at just $29.99 a month, and you can lock in your price for a year. With no startup costs and 99.9% digital signal reliability, DirecTV has had higher customer satisfaction rates ratings than cable 8 years in a row. If you're in need of a TV stimulus plan, call 1-888-359-5566. Call right now and ask about free next day installation. Call 1-888-359-5566. That's 1-888-359-5566. Offer ends 7709. New DirecTV customers only, subject to credit approval. Call for details. Among the largest national cable and satellite TV providers, 2008 American Customer Satisfaction Index, University of Michigan Business School.
The
The raw power of a Harley-Davidson could be yours. Motor City Harley-Davidson's Harley Fest 2009. Presented by 101, WRIF, and Miller Lite. Win a sweet 2009 Harley-Davidson XL 1200 Nightster. Courtesy of Motor City Harley-Davidson. Get on the list to win a key to these sweet wheels. July 11th at Hill Creek Ranch. Plus, details on how you can win a key in person. Feel the rush. Harley Fest 2009. Presented by Motor City Harley-Davidson. Feel the freedom of the number one dealer in Farmington Hills. Also from Miller Lite. Taste greatness. And your Harley Fest station. 101 WRIF.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Joined by Jalene Jordan, this is our final segment. At 1 a.m., I'm going to be interviewing Steve Early. He is written Embedded with Organized Labor, Journalistic Reflections on the Class War at Home.
Whew.
Ooh, yeah.
He's sexy.
Talking about the current state of the union movement. Another place where we could get some money, the military budget, of course, is just bloated with waste, probably a good $750 billion a year we could save. And the new issue of Mother Jones for July and August, motherjones.com, I think it is, yeah, motherjones.com, is a magazine, something that comes out six times a year, should be read, and the lead story is totally wasted, and it shows actually a joint that's been wrapped in a $100 bill, and it's burning, and it says, we've blown $300 billion, death squads roam Mexico, cartels operate in 259 U.S. cities. This is your war on drugs. Any questions? That's what it says on the cover. He says $300 billion. I read last week from Nicholas Kristof, columnist for the New York Times, drugs won the war. And he quotes Norm Stamper, a former police chief of Seattle, who told him, quote, we've spent $1 trillion prosecuting the war on drugs. And what do we have to show for it, says Norm Stamper? Drugs are more readily available at lower prices, higher levels of potency. It's a dismal failure.
We have, you know, we have to show for it a bunch of really stoned people.
Yes, exactly. Hey. And a lot of, wait a minute, and a lot of imprisoned people whose lives have been made miserable because they wanted to change their consciousness. Lock them up!
Please, give me a break. Yeah. We got an email from Joe who said he'd like to hear someone ask these conservatives if socialized medicine is so bad, why hasn't one country, not one country, ever gone back to private health insurance system once that country went to a government-run program? I think that's a great question.
I hate it when listeners are smarter than me. You know, they often are.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, they are.
Because there's a lot of smart people out there.
There are, and this is a thinking audience, not like these conservatives. When you listen to these right-wing talk shows like I did on that trip to Baltimore.
Why do you do this to yourself?
I don't know. I never do. I always tell people, why bother to listen? But anyway, so according to the Gallup poll, 40% of Americans say that they're conservative, yet I see when they ask people on issues, they come out way to the left. For much of his public career, Senator John Ensign of Nevada appeared to be a model of the religious right. By this week, he had become just another politician diminished by scandal. Rattled, humbled, and alone at the podium, Senator Ensign said, he acknowledged to reporters an extramarital affair, the sort of moral failing he's criticized in the past. What hypocrites these guys are.
He's bummed out he got caught.
Yeah, you know what? I don't. Anytime a liberal senator, and I mean, they've never been caught in the manner that these conservatives are. It's like they're all
maybe
doing
the President Clinton.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they just couldn't any liberal just say, "Well, hey, it's between me and my wife. Don't even bother me with that." But because liberals don't represent themselves as the paragon of virtue, of Christianity embodied, the Lord's work, and
ever.
All that crap.
I would never ever do that. No way.
For Nevadans, he was known as a polished pro-business Republican. Is there any other kind? And well-spoken ally of the state's religious conservatives. He was a member of Promise Keepers, a men's Christian group that espoused devotion to family and marriage.
Well, there you go.
Let's see here. Ensign's political life was entwined with his religious belief. Once in Washington, he lived for a time with other Christian lawmakers who organized prayer breakfasts and Bible study.
He was having all these like really
banging,
crazy
banging
stuff.
His aide.
Who was he banging? It was his.
It says it in here. He continued to attend an evangelical church in Las Vegas with his wife, Darlene, who did not move to Washington with him. Henson has opposed abortion and gay marriage and back school vouchers for religious schools. Let's see. It was actually pretty...
But cheating on your wife is totally okay. If you have an open marriage, do your thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you think he had an open marriage?
No. God, no.
Yeah. Actually, what he did was something or other with an aide and his aide's husband. I mean, that wasn't a sexual
thing. They had a three-way?
No.
Was there a cigar involved?
See if we can move on. You know, here's the point. Right. Thank you. Outfit in Hamtramck is called a burka, not a chador. It's a burqa. I don't know why I couldn't come up with that phrase.
But what's...
That's the long robe.
Well, the one with the whole covering.
Yeah. Well, burqa and a chador are both covered. I think a chador is like maybe an arame. It's just different things. And other, you know, other parts
head
of religion.
Head
covering and what have you.
Yeah.
But this was an article. Somehow we're getting late into the show. I don't think I'm going to read this. But this is talking about how the far right wing, the British National Party, which is really a fascist party. I mean, it was pro-Nazi during the late 30s and what have you. They now have been able to elect a couple of guys to the European Parliament, and it looks like they could get people elected to the British Parliament when, you know, after Labour is falling deservedly flat on his face after Tony
Blair
and this latest character Brown. What's Brown's first name?
I don't know. I really don't know.
I don't know. I'm thinking of too many things though. That's for sure. I keep thinking. I almost said a guy who I know his name. I don't.
Hey, back on the burqa subject. We got an email from Donald who said if she was true to her religion, her husband would have stood up for her. She's probably not allowed in court in her home country. And then he put in parentheses, hypocrite.
Oh, that's right. I mean, meaning that she is. Yeah, I mean, that's what I said. You can't have it both ways. In the countries in which women are required either by law or by tradition to wear burqas or chadors or whatever, they don't come into court on their own as independent actors in the public sphere.
Yeah.
They're not.
They barely go out of the house.
They barely go out of the house. Unless they have to be accompanied by another female. I mean, in Saudi Arabia, who we send billions of dollars to every year of our tax dollars, that sometimes when they saw a woman out with a male relative that they've both been whipped, for instance.
Daniel, who is 16 years old, who listens to the show. Hi, Daniel. He said that he believes, as you said, Peter, she has two options. She can either abide by her religion and have the man of the family or household take up the case, or abide by our legal system in the occurrence of such a case. But we don't know really the whole mass.
Well, here, just going back to the British far right getting representation in Parliament, in the European Parliament and perhaps in the British one as well when the elections come up, this is what's happening. So everybody says, oh, all right, we're going to go to the left, as if Barack Obama was truly a left candidate, which he's not. He's a centrist. It just that, you know, Bush was so far to the right that he made Barack Obama a true centrist look like somehow a politician of the left. So people now are going to get discouraged, like that one, the letter writer, the email I got from somebody who says that Barack Obama has betrayed us, even though he supported him. So now people are going to, this is what will happen. And then they'll say, okay, well, let's get the right wing and the conservatives in there. And they'll go, oh, no, they've screwed us up, too. Let's go back to the liberal. So it's just this treadmill of hoping these politicians are going to bail us out rather than creating an agenda of our own. All right, let's see here. We want to get some more callers in here. Oh, let's see. Paul from Redford's been waiting patiently. Paul, hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you, Peter and Jolene. I actually have good news about one Republican, at least.
What's that?
Really?
And that's Ron Paul of Texas, who, along with Democrat Barney Frank, have reintroduced a bill that would allow farmers to grow industrial hemp in America once again.
Wow. Yeah, like it was during World War II.
Well,
hemp for victory.
For a short time, for victory.
Yeah.
Which happened as a need after the introduction of the bills which stopped hemp. And, you know, America realized, hey, this is a valuable crop. Well, here with our with hemp being able to replace everything that we can make out of petrochemicals, it makes sense with global warming to use the only plant that can do the very same thing. And if anybody wants information, they can drop by the Michigan Hemp booth at the Homer Park Green Art Fair, which is this coming Sunday.
Okay, well, good. And, yeah, and if anybody wants more information on that, you can just Google industrial hemp. And when we're talking about Hemp for Victory, that was a government documentary that was put together during World War II that showed the importance of growing hemp. Hemp was grown by George Washington and what have you. Thank you, Paul. Thanks for the information. And, yeah, Palmer Park, a green fair.
Nice.
Yeah, very nice indeed. Here is Larry calling from Vancouver, British Columbia. Larry, thanks for making our show international.
Hi. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
And Jolene.
Hello.
Still a very informative and entertaining show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk to you about the healthcare.
Sure.
Actually, it's quite hard and not. It's quite hard to understand all the healthcare debate in the United States. But I was watching some of the clips from one of the Senate hearings last week, and I thought Bernie Sanders asked some good questions to some of the witnesses.
Well, he's a socialist.
Yeah.
He is. He really is. But he's the independent senator from Vermont. He's neither a Republican or a Democrat, although he caucuses with the Democrats and considers himself what's called, and people don't even know this phrase very much in the United States, Larry, he considers himself a democratic socialist in the manner of that same politics in Europe.
Yes.
Yeah.
When I was watching that particular hearing, I saw a witness from Safeway Incorporated.
Uh-huh.
Talking about the U.S. health plan that they have. But I kept wondering why none of the senators didn't ask about Safeway's health plan in Canada or like other places, right?
Yeah.
So basically my question is, why doesn't the U.S. subsidiaries in Canada or other countries, you know, I believe that the U.S. subsidiaries in Canada or other countries, you know, they save money, they save costs, right?
By right. Having
universal health care.
Sure.
But why... there's no common sense about this in the United States. It doesn't make sense to me.
I don't understand it. If companies would think, man, we can pass off all of our health care costs to the government. What a cool thing. But I think that it's almost reflexive of being these traditionally conservative Republicans, the corporate elite in the main. There's exceptions, but in the main they're Republican and they're conservative, and they've always opposed health care on ideological grounds. It's almost like if you know that somehow that we'll make healthcare a government function, and that the next step will be workers' councils will want to take over their companies or something. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't make a bit of sense to me. Yeah.
Well, that's just my question. It doesn't make any business sense to me.
No, I know. I never could understand it. I don't know why now. Chrysler, and you'd think particularly since Fiat has such a big piece of it, they wouldn't be saying, hey, come on, we don't want to pay all this healthcare stuff. Let's let the government take it over. It doesn't make a bit of sense. Larry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. A couple of lines open in the moments remaining. Here's Todd in Detroit. Todd, hi, it's Peter and Jolene.
Hey, Peter, what's up?
Nothing much.
Hey, Jolene, don't spit on people.
I was just joking.
Well, that's not nice, and it's against the law, actually.
That's assault. I wanted to know. I've never spit on anyone in my life.
That's assault.
I said, is it illegal? Now.
It's against the law. Don't do that.
I wouldn't do it. I'm way too nice. I may sound like a bit of a...
You're a sweetheart.
Oh, thank you.
Anyway, I was probably... the thing about the Afghanistan war and what's going on in Afghanistan, I just watched the Charlie Wilson war movie.
Sure.
I haven't seen that.
Charlie Wilson's War, yeah.
It was awesome. I watched it, and it was pretty intriguing. I was like, do you think that, like, what everything that went on with that is, like, what's, like, affecting what's going on now, or...
Well, it's just like what's happening in Iran now. You can trace back to American policy as much as 50 and 60 years ago without going through a whole deal with that. Mostly Americans face situations when they've come to a crisis point. Why all of a sudden are these crazy people saying they hate the U.S. so much? What did we ever do to them? Well, you kind of have to go back and examine American foreign policy in Afghanistan and Iran and all of that, and you get an idea why a lot of people are not very comfortable with what we've done to them and their country.
Well, we bailed them out, right?
Who?
We bailed Afghanistan out against the Russians, right?
Well, no. The idea was to create a Russian Vietnam. That was what Brzezinski, the national security advisor to Carter, figured out that they could do. They could create a situation where the Soviets would wind up with an insurgency that would be financed by the United States, as it was. But it turned out to be that we were financing this Mujahideen, these far-right-wing religionists who produced the best-known one of all, Osama bin Laden. So, on one hand, the Soviets were handed a stinging defeat. On the other hand, we set the seeds of exactly what's going on there now.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, he's next. Todd from Detroit, thank you very much.
There's a great book by Robert Fisk, and I can't remember the title, but it goes into all of that. So look up Robert Fisk. He's great. And quick, an email from Robert says, I'm learning a lot from you guys. He says he may not be the brightest bulb, but he knows the truth when he hears it. Damn it.
Well, you know what my motto is, right?
Which one? You have a lot of them.
I have a lot of mottos. Coming from Leonard Skinner. I know a little, and I can guess the rest.
Right.
That's all you really need. You don't have to know all the detail. Here's Maurice in Detroit. Maurice, thanks for waiting so patiently.
Happy to join. How you doing?
We're doing good.
Maurice.
Yeah, how you doing? You know, last week I was commenting on Mike Cox.
Mike Cox, yeah, the attorney general who's...
Yeah. The thing about it is, why would somebody investigate him on the investigation that he didn't do? Now, who wants a fool like that is the competent running the state? You couldn't even do your job as Secretary of State.
Yeah, you're right. Maurice, Jolene misunderstood you.
What did she thought I said?
Instead of Mike, she thought you said my.
No, Jolene.
That's a little personal, Maurice.
It's all good. It's all good. Happy Father's Day, Peter.
Okay, same to you, man. Man, I actually recovered.
You did.
There's only two people in the world that can make me laugh uncontrollably, and...
I'm one of them.
Yeah, one of them.
And
Maurice, my sister.
And your sister.
And, yeah,
we'll
yeah.
add Maurice.
And Roger writes, I thought I heard the same thing. You did.
Okay.
All right, here's Ed in Ypsilanti. Ooh. Ed, thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just had a quick question and then a comment.
Sure.
It was about the court case with the veil.
Sure.
My first question, the question is, was pretty much the veil just looked at it and said, okay, you know what, could you please remove the veil? She said no, and then he threw it out, or was there anything before that?
You know, I'm actually remiss. I mean, sometimes it's hard to, you know, we're trying to make educated decisions here, and we don't have all the information. It puts all of us at a disadvantage. I remember when this happened. It was about a year and a half ago or so, and I remember, I don't know at what point the judge said, look, you know, I cannot render a decision with one of the parties having their face completely covered, and if we're going to continue, you're going to have to remove it. And there was a bunch of appeals and what have you, and I think it maybe never was even adjudicated, but rather it went to the Supreme Court, which held that in fact that the local Hamtramck judge had the right to determine certain standards of appearance in the courtroom.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's mainly what I was confused about, and because my comment was pretty much going to be, well, that seems kind of lame that just because she wanted to have, she was saying, well, this is my religion, I would like it if you respected it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not a huge believer in religion whatsoever, but I believe, you know, you have the right to believe and express your belief system, what have you. It's just, I was thinking, you mean she got tossed out because of her demeanor? You mean
No, because demeanor meaning you want to be able to look at the person's face in order to be able to tell things. Well, let me ask you this. Say you and I were involved in a civil suit the way she was. It was a small claims court, and she was making a claim. And you walked into court, and you go, okay, I'm going to tell the judge my side. And you looked over, and I was covered from head to toe, and all you could see were my eyes. I mean, that doesn't seem to me to be equality before the law. I mean, it would seem to me, in fact, I would think that it would be the opposite. It would almost make the judge or a jury prejudicial given our customs and traditions and what have you. But on the other hand, someone who is completely disguised, if you will, out of their own choice, I mean, it's kind of an odd situation to be sure.
But I think they may even make you take your hat off in the courtroom.
Oh, what do you mean? Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was.
They didn't make me take one off when I went.
You could leave your hat on?
I left my hat on. Back in 1999.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I had dreadlocks, and I didn't want the judge to see them because I thought he would judge me.
That's also a Joe Cocker song, Leave Your Hat On.
Yes, it is.
But they always
play
strip clubs.
You know, Etta James sings the hell out of that,
really?
Too. Yeah.
All right, Ed, thank you very much for your comments. Thanks for being our last caller. Jalene Jordan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you to Roger.
Thank you, Roger.
Yeah.
Thanks to all the listeners for calling in.
Yeah, and listening.
Yes.
As well.
Right. We'll be back next week.
And we're going to take a break, and then back with Steve Early. He's going to talk about the current State of the Union movie. Oh, man, that's really exciting. Why do I always have to apologize for these guests? Look, I wouldn't put these people on if I didn't think that they had something important to say to all of us. It's not, like, super exciting, like what star is dating what star or anything
right,
like
yeah.
that.
Like but John and Kate, will they divorce or not?
I didn't even know what the hell that was about until about 2 weeks ago.
Well, why am I not surprised?
Yeah. And I've been too busy watching Bruce Willis films.
Oh, please.
Yeah, we just got HBO.
Yeah.
This is like a drug. I never used to watch television at all. I get this big television screen, we get cable, then we get HBO. And
you're losing it, Peter.
Yeah, but Bruce Willis, it was, what was it called, Live Free or Die Hard?
Okay.
Did you see that one?
I don't watch those types, no.
He takes out a helicopter that's chasing him with a car.
Lovely.
And he also...
So sorry I missed it.
He single-handedly takes down an F-35 U.S. fighter jet.
Wow, he's amazing. Not Bruce Willis.
All right, that's exciting. I'm going to go see the new Transformers movie.
Oh, my.
I'm into mindless entertainment. All right, stay tuned for the interviews, and we'll talk again next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. 101 WRIF, streaming worldwide at WRIF.com. The Riff wants to know how we can improve your iPhone 3G experience. We hope you'll take a brief survey at WRIF.com/iPhone and tell us how you use your iPhone 3G. Thanks again for listening at WRIF.com.
Please stay tuned to the following public announcement. The government and private banks are liquidating houses now. These houses have been foreclosed, confiscated, or repossessed, and will be sold. Homes may be sold for very little money down. To learn how to receive a free list of foreclosures, call 800-354-8211. All listeners whose last name begins with the letter A through N are allowed to start calling now. Listeners whose last name begins with O through Z can begin calling tomorrow, 9 a.m. Every house must be sold. The government and banks are very motivated to sell these homes quickly, so listings may not always remain available in all areas. So act now. I repeat, this is a public announcement. All listeners whose last name begins with the letter A through N can start calling now. Listeners whose last name begins with O through Z can begin calling tomorrow, 9 a.m. Call CRN's national toll-free hotline to learn how to receive your free foreclosure list at 800-354-8211. That's 800-354-8211.
If you have acne, here's a phone number you need to call. 1-800-335-4191. Right now, we're looking for the biggest skeptics out there to test out a skin-clearing breakthrough risk-free. If that's you, give us a call. We're going to prove you can make your acne disappear and have clear skin by sending you a 60-day trial of Proactive Solution absolutely risk-free with our compliments. And when you call now, we'll also send you our Green Tea Moisturizer, a feather-like serum that absorbs instantly to deliver deep hydration for free. Call 1-800-335-4191.
Our combination therapy system uses prescription-grade acne medicine. It's so effective, it transforms blemishes and bumps into clear, smooth skin and skeptics into believers. You can have beautiful, healthy-looking skin. Put Proactiv to the test, and we'll prove it. Get your free soothing green tea moisturizer with your risk-free 60-day trial by calling now. 1-800-335-4191. 1-800-335-4191.
Do you owe taxes to the IRS that you can't afford to pay? What will you do? Your tax problem will only get worse if you don't do something about it. If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Pick up the phone and call 1-800-493-8157. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debts for less than you owe. Remove penalties and interest, and get the tax collector off your case. As an honest, hard-working American, you do have rights. Don't let your tax problem get worse. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159. When it's hot outside, make sure you're staying cool inside with a new air conditioning system from Sears. Just go to heatandcool.com and save $350. It's a hot offer that's getting hotter because now you can get a tax credit up to $1,500 from the government's 2009 stimulus package. Details at energystar.gov. Sears has a full line of Kenmore and Carrier cooling systems. You can trust Sears for reliable service and installation. And when you go to heatandcool.com, you can save $350. So stay cool, save energy, and save money with Sears. Just go to heatandcool.com. Offer ends June 30th. Not available in all areas. Installation provided by Sears authorized licensed contractors. License information available upon request. That's heatandcool.com. Or click the Sears banner on your screen. Save $350 on a new air conditioning system from Sears. Go to heatandcool.com.
Do you want a wireless laptop, but your credit score is holding you back? We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop, no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronics Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Then hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased with their service, so I would suggest to anyone that is looking for computers or trying to find computers, Tronics is the best place to call.
Call now and lock in your free gifts. You will not be turned down. Call 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258.
An owned record label.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. And the phone-in talk shows that I do, here in an area that we talk about, we at least used to talk about as the Motor City, a labor center of the United States, the home of the UAW, that many young people and even people older say, well, the unions were okay for my father, the unions were okay for my grandfather even, and unions as the core mechanism for defending working people's rights, I don't think is in the general consciousness anymore. Well, full disclosure, I'm a longtime member of the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, AFL-CIO, so I don't come to this subject or our guest as a neutral observer. I have very strong opinions in this, which will come out as does my guest. My guest is Steve Early. He's written a book called Embedded with Organized Labor, Journalistic Reflections on the Class War at Home. And Steve Early has been an organizer, strike strategist, labor
labor educator, and lawyer. He recently retired from his job as national staff member of the Communications Workers of America, and he's had articles, reviews, and op-ed pieces in The Nation, New Politics, Counterpunch, Los Angeles Times, even The Wall Street Journal, and The New York Times. Steve Early, we reach him in his office in Boston. Welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks for having me on, Peter.
Well, there's so much just in the title. I love that, because that's always a good place to start. Embedded, that phrase came into being at the time of the Iraq War, the latest one, where there were reporters who were embedded with units, and the idea that there was a critical sense that they were too close to their subject. So you're embedded with organized labor. Tell us what you mean in the title, but also what does that give you in terms of a perspective, and can you have a critical distance?
Well, I try to. I've been an activist in the labor movement for the last 35 years, most of that time spent as a national staff member, organizer, and field rep for the Communication Workers of America. But during all the years that I was doing day-to-day union work, helping members with their grievances and helping local unions negotiate contracts and working on strikes and organizing campaigns, I also tried to do as much freelance writing as I could about labor-related topics. So I guess you could call me a participatory labor journalist. Labor journalism in the mainstream media is a dwindling field, but I tried to keep alive the tradition of being a participant observer and writing about the movements and activities of the labor movement that I was involved in. And this new book is a collection of that work.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in terms of critical distance, I think we'll find as we continue with our interview with Steve Early that he does have criticisms of the current labor movement. But let's save that just for a while. Let's go to the positive. You heard me as I introduced you that there are many people of a lot of times people of this generation, the younger generation, but also older people who say, well, unions were good. Sure, they gave us the weekend. Sure, they gave us any number of benefits. And they were active during the 30s and the 40s, and they set the context for what we have now. But now, you know, they're bureaucratic. They don't do the jobs they're supposed to. And I can do better as an individual. Steve Early, how do you respond to that?
Well, I think that is a familiar mantra, but it's one that has definitely been running out of steam lately. Due to the economic downturn of the last 6 to 12 months, I mean, we've seen millions of people laid off from their jobs, forced to work shorter work weeks. Many people have taken pay cuts. They're on furlough. Their pay has been frozen. They've lost their job-based health insurance coverage or are paying much more for their medical benefits as a result of employer-initiated health care cost shifting. And most seriously of all, for those of us near retirement age, people's retirement savings have been badly eroded due to the elimination of traditional group pension coverage and its replacement by the pretty disastrous experiment with individual retirement accounts, 401ks and IRAs, whose value has been vaporized by the collapse of the market. All of these negative workplace trends add up to a very good reason for people to have a voice at work.
Have union members fared better in this period?
Well, the big difference, and you can see it in the auto industry, where the results are still quite painful, when workers have collective bargaining rights, when they have the right to negotiate about changes in their wages, hours, and working conditions, that's an important tool. Traditionally, as you pointed out, to make gains, to make advances, to raise wage levels and improve the standard of living. But even in a downturn, when the bargaining is defensive, it's better to have a voice than not have a voice. And if you're going to take backward steps, you want them to be negotiated. You don't want them to be unilaterally imposed by the employers, and that is the fate of the close to 90% of the American workforce that doesn't have collective bargaining rights today.
How did things get to this point? What was the high point of union membership in the private sector, let's say? And it's pretty low now, isn't it?
Yes. The high point of unionization was in the early 1950s, about 33%, definitely reflecting the wave of mass organizing in industries like auto and steel and trucking and rubber manufacturing, tire manufacturing, the big Midwestern basic industries. Since that 1953 peak, there has been a steady decline in unionization in the private sector. It's down to near 7%. The numbers have been bucked up a bit by the growth of unions in the public sector, in government employment. But overall, only about 12% of American workers are currently represented by unions.
And what happened? What I mean, part of it is, of course, people say that unions got fat and bureaucratic. Many of them became corrupt, that they didn't represent their workers, that there was just careerism, what if you use a phrase from the 1920s, that these unions became run by pork choppers. I love that phrase. In other words, men usually that were in it only for the pork chops for themselves, and it became maybe emblematic of the most emblematic would be the Teamsters at its worst.
Well, definitely some of the flaws in union organizations themselves have contributed to the decline. But I think they're really secondary factors, as serious as they are in those unions which have had, and in some cases continue to have, problems with internal corruption and lack of democracy and other abuses of membership rights. There's no better example of the global forces that have been undermining unionization and good union jobs than what's happened to Detroit. The decline of manufacturing, the outsourcing of jobs, the conversion of many good-paying full-time jobs into part-time jobs, people being reclassified as independent contractors, the whole shift from manufacturing to the service sector. There's a number of larger economic forces which have worked against the labor movement and undermined its past gains. But I think to recover, to go on the offensive, we need a program both of internal revitalization to address some of the problems within unions that you just mentioned, and we need to build stronger alliances with other forces in society that have also been adversely affected by these workplace trends.
My guest is Steve Early on the Peter Werbe Show. His book is Embedded with Organized Labor, Journalistic Reflections on the Class War at Home. He's both a labor journalist and an attorney and labor organizer himself, recently retired. And you can go to monthlyreview.org. Monthly Review Press is who published it, and an excellent source of material. And there'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. One of the things, I always say this just to kind of throw people for a loop. Usually if you ask people, what's the function of a labor union, they'll say, well, to defend working people. But I carry it a little bit further and to say, and this is maybe a little too abstract, but still I think it's accurate, that unions defend the average selling price of labor. But when you talk about a free market, we would still all, probably the highest wage in the United States for a working person would be about $3 an hour if it had to go on the global market. And, well, let me put it this way, even the domestic market, let alone now in a globalized market, that probably wages would on the free market would be very, very low. So unions kick up the price, and well that they should, because we deserve to be compensated as well as possible within financial integrity of an enterprise. But given the globalization, given the fact now that you buy a Ford product and you think, oh, I just bought a union car, right? And you bought a Fusion, and you didn't. It was made in Hermosillo, Mexico, for guys making $2.50 an hour. So it worries me that given the globalization of labor and capital, that it's going to be a tough road to hoe.
Very definitely. And one of the challenges that some unions have begun to meet better than others is building cross-border alliances with workers' organizations in Canada, in Mexico, in the rest of Central America and South America, Asia, and Western Europe, so that when they're dealing with common employers, they can plot strategy together, conduct joint campaigns, coordinate their activities, because otherwise powerful multinational companies, which really owe their allegiance to no national flag or nation state, will pit the workers of one country against another.
Well, I don't know if the United Auto Workers, who I used to work for, more full disclosure, if they still call themselves, I should know this, the International United Auto Workers, and they did that because they had locals in Canada, but which left quite a while ago to form the Canadian Auto Workers. But I never quite understood why the UAW didn't take up unionization even directly in Mexico with Mexican organizers in, like, the Ford plants, the GM plants, and what have you.
Well, I think at the official level, there has been some outreach on the part of the UAW. Some of the cross-border networking, some of the best cross-border networking has been done by unofficial groups. A Detroit-based organization known as Labor Notes, which conducts educational conferences and puts out a monthly newsletter for the last 30 years for labor activists, has sponsored conferences every 2 years in Dearborn, which has brought together trade unionists from throughout the world. And Labor Notes has been very active in establishing ties with similar or labor groups in other countries and promoting cross-border activity at the rank-and-file level so that we're not simply working through the bureaucracies of national unions here and in other countries to get done what needs to be done to confront the employers and the common challenge of globalization.
Labor Notes is good, and those conferences are key for people interested in the labor movement, whether you're in a union or not. And I'm trying to remember whether they had one last year or was it the year before?
It was last April, and the next one is coming up in the spring of 2010.
Yeah, it'll be right around the Detroit area. As usual, are the labor organizations now, the unions, up to the task that's confronting labor, but also, and we should expand on this, all working people, because people often think that their union, they're the elite, they're special, they don't, they're the privileged. I don't, and there's often even this resentment attendant. But does the unions now, as they're constituted, have the stuff to do what needs to be done?
Well, I think one area where the labor movement definitely needs to project itself and position itself as a defender of all workers and can do that is in the current struggle for some kind of meaningful health care reform. Our system of job-based medical coverage, often provided through private for-profit health insurance companies, is falling apart. It's definitely failing the millions of people who've lost their jobs and are now, in many cases, without coverage. In Washington, the labor movement is trying to be a part of a coalition to enact real health care reform. And this would benefit not only the workers who have the right to bargain about their medical benefits, but the millions who have no say and the millions more who have no coverage whatsoever.
Well, labor put in an amazing amount of money into the election of Barack Obama and expected, as labor often does when it backs Democratic Party candidates, that they're going to get a big return. Usually, they get very little back, sometimes none, nothing. And so far, given the extent of the effort of the UAW, for instance, in Ohio and Pennsylvania, is Barack Obama doing what he could or should for labor?
I think he definitely needs a lot to feel a lot more heat from the rank and file. The Democrats, I would agree, are always a disappointment waiting to happen where labor issues are concerned. And you can see the powerful forces on the other side of the health care reform debate already watering down the proposals of the administration and the Democratic leadership in Congress. The wing of the labor movement, which supports a single-payer solution, would like to see enacted in this country a Canadian-style Medicare for All program, which I think is the only real solution to the healthcare crisis, has continued to be quite active and tried to keep that perspective part of the debate. On the other side, we have employers, insurance companies, the doctors' association, the pharmaceutical industry, and many conservatives in both major parties who are looking, I think, instead to patch band-aids onto the existing system and not really engineer any fundamental change.
I don't get it, though, why Ron Gettelfinger, the president of the United Auto Workers and the president of General Motors, don't have their arms linked, singing Solidarity Forever, demanding a universal single-payer health care system. That would take so much off of particularly big employers. Why aren't the big employers more for a government health program?
Well, in my experience, trying as a union rep to challenge employers both large and small to join the labor movement in lobbying for real national health insurance, to get this issue off the bargaining table, to eliminate it as a cost burden for employers directly, many are reluctant to do it. Some have signed on to joint health care reform activity, but I think it's an ideological problem. They do not want to see the social wage expanded. They don't want to see another big social insurance program launched, even though it would be good for their own individual bottom line.
Yeah, I don't get it. I think you're right. I think it's just reflexive that, pardon me, that, you know, it's that phrase that came about, I guess, was in the late 40s, socialized medicine. Although I don't think that's such a bad word to anybody under 50 anymore. Socialized, socialism, of course, put up images of the Soviet Union and repressive government intervening in every aspect of our life. And all of a sudden, a film like Sicko comes out about the health industry here and abroad by Michael Moore, and suddenly you say, well, gee, every other country has a system where the government is the single payer or some variant of that, and it works out real well, and it takes enormous cost off the individual and employers.
I would agree. I spent some time as a union rep with CWA members in Eastern Canada, and it makes a tremendous difference in terms of union contract negotiations to not have to be spending so much time and energy wrangling over who's going to pay what for what kind of benefit coverage. There is no solution to the problem of medical cost inflation at any one bargaining table, at any one company, in any one industry. And in Canada, people have cradle-to-the-grave health security. Sure, there are problems with the system depending on the level of funding in which province you live in, but people know that even if they're laid off, if they're forced into early retirement, if they get sick and lose their job, they're going to be covered, and the health care is accessible, it's affordable, it's everything that it's not in this country because it's tied to people's jobs for the most part, and the private insurance companies rate 30% off of every dollar that we spend and waste it on their own profits, marketing, administrative costs, and other forms of overhead that are absolutely unnecessary and would be eliminated in a single-payer system.
Mm-hmm. The book is Embedded with Organized Labor, Journalistic Reflections on the Class War at Home. Pardon me. Steve Early is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. Boy, I cannot kick this springtime cold. I'm doing everything I can not to to cough, but Steve Early has a few more minutes with us, so I think I can get through that. One, in fact, maybe the single biggest priority of the organized labor movement is the Employee Free Choice Act, which is called EFCA, E-F-C-A, and it would change the rules for how you can organize in a workplace. It was essentially a card checkoff system where you get over 50% and then you can have a union. This was agreed by the Democrats and by Barack Obama to also take this up as a number one priority, but it's right now, I don't think its chances look good. Do you?
Well, there have definitely been some instances of waffling within the Senate, where we're first faced with the problem of having to have a supermajority, 60 votes to cut off any Republican filibuster, which is what killed the last major bid for labor law reform 30 years ago. The labor movement is doing a much better job than it did then, mobilizing members to keep the pressure on the Democrats and on the administration to bring this to a vote and to get these long overdue changes in federal labor law enacted. It is really very disappointing that in the midst of an economic crisis like this, where workers clearly need a strengthened tool for raising their wages, for improving their living standards, that so many Democrats are now acting like this is not a good time. We can't afford to strengthen workers' rights to organize and bargain during this bad economy, when the bad economy economy is the number one reason why we need to strengthen workers' rights.
Well, I was going to say, that's the employer's argument. The United States Chamber of Commerce, now led by ex-Governor Engler of Michigan, says exactly that. I mean, you're trying to get wages boosted at a time when companies are hurting. That could just make the recession worse.
Well, they made the same argument in the depths of the Great Depression when the law that we're trying to amend now, the National Labor Relations Act or the Wagner Act, was first enacted. The employers made the same argument in the 1930s against federal support for collective bargaining, against the minimum wage, against child labor protection, against the creation of Social Security, the eight-hour day. All of these protective labor measures that were enacted as part of the New Deal were all supposedly going to wreak havoc in the economy, destroy jobs, and reduce everyone to poverty. And in fact, those all proved to be important means of uplifting the working class at a time when it was suffering due to economic conditions not unlike those we're facing today.
Mm-hmm. We've just got a couple minutes left with Steve Early. You said the phrase working class. That seems like something from the 1930s. Usually now even the AFL talks about working families. It's certainly the subtitle of your book, Embedded with Organized Labor, Journalistic Reflections on the Class War at Home. That, too, people could say, wow, that sounds too rad, or that's 1930s talk. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think the reality is that the vast majority of people in this country, however they may think of themselves, are white-collar or blue-collar workers. They work for a salary or a wage. If they had any substantial savings in their retirement fund or equity in their homes, for many people, the value out of it has been greatly reduced. People are, in fact, part of a working-class majority. It may not, in many instances, look like the traditional working class of blue-collar manufacturing and in the Detroit of yore, but in terms of relationship to the means of production, relationship to those on the other side of the class divide who own and control the wealth of the country, the vast majority of us are relatively disenfranchised economically, and unless we get our act together politically, that condition is only going to worsen.
Well, class war, that doesn't sound peaceful at all. That sounds like something with workers fighting the cops and scabs in the streets of the 1930s.
Well, the war, for the most part, is a one-sided one being waged on workers and their families by the other side, by management, by the corporations. And you can see the effect of that in the steadily deteriorating job conditions, pay, benefits, and job security of millions of people.
Well, I guess one unanswered question, and I probably didn't pose it strong enough, are the current labor formations up to the task that you see of what's ahead for working people throughout the country, both in unions and inside unions and outside?
Well, in Washington at the moment, there is an attempt to get the two major labor federations, the AFL-CIO and Change to Win Coalition, which was created 4 years ago, and a third group, the National Association, National Education Association, the largest teachers union, together as part of a coalition, a labor unity group that would lobby more effectively with Congress and the Obama administration. I think that's fine, but what we really need in the labor movement is much more kind of bottom-up revitalization, much more membership participation, much more of a role for the rank and file, and that's really been the mission of groups like Labor Notes, based in Detroit, to try to promote that kind of bottom-up transformation of unions that would make them more effective defenders of their members and the interests of the community.
Mm-hmm. And you get a nice endorsement on the back of your book from Jane Slaughter from Labor Notes. She says, Steve Early says things other people in labor would like to say but don't because of protocol, fear of firing, or if truth be told, fear of afflicting the comfortable. And this is a book, whether you're in a union or not, that gives you an idea what needs to be done if we're not all just just to thatch our roofs. I don't think we want to do that. Embedded with Organized Labor is the book. The subtitle is Journalistic Reflections on the Class War at Home. Steve Early has been my guest. It's published by Monthly Review Press. You go to monthlyreview.org or my website, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E. Steve Early, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. The home of WRIF.com. Get the latest rock news, concert listings, and where Riff is rocking the streets. Check out Motor City's deals and deals and get stuff for half price. Or your 101 The Riff online from anywhere in the world.
Website.
Websites worldwide.
101 WRIF at WRIF.com. Everything rocks.
Time's running out. You're maxed out on your credit cards. The collection calls are coming every day, and now you're two payments behind on your mortgage. Every time you turn on the radio, there's some cheerful couple telling you how they got out of debt overnight. Their stress is gone, and everything's just wonderful. Come on. The truth is, what sounds too good to be true is too good to be true. You need real help, and you need it now. Not bankruptcy. That should be your last choice. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're the only attorney-driven program dedicated to helping you get out of debt in months instead of years, saving you thousands, and without risking your family home. We know what we're doing, and we don't make promises we can't keep. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Get out of debt. Call Credit Card Relief at 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282. Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging lime scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, which cost you up to 25% more. That's an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy. With HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents lime scale buildup in your entire plumbing system, guaranteed. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances and save money with HydraCare. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. Lower your energy costs. Visit bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com.
Attention, Hydralyze is currently seeking participants with dark circles and puffy eyes. If you have dark circles or bags around your eyes due to heredity, fatigue, or aging, you are eligible to see results and participate in the Hydralyze trial. Hydralyze was introduced to improve delicate skin around the eyes and now has been shown to eliminate dark circles and bags. It effectively diminishes even dark circles caused by heredity. To participate in the Hydralyze trial and see results risk-free, call 1-800-505-7931. Fragile capillaries around the eye can leak, allowing blood to pool beneath the skin like an ugly bruise. But right now, you can join the thousands of people who have seen their dark circles fade away, watched as bags literally disappeared from view. Participate in the free trial by calling today. If you're serious about getting rid of your dark circles or bags around the eyes, you are eligible to participate and experience results with Hydralyze. Call this number today, 1-800-505-7931. Once more, that's 1-800-505-7931.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you, and it's baseball season, right? You're getting hockey out of the way and basketball out of the way and all that. So it's summertime. It's the boys of summer. Tigers already, doing some damage. We'll see what happens as the summer progresses. Baseball has always, like everything, just been rift with politics and considerations way beyond what goes on in the field. And this, I'm hesitating here because I have a book in front of me that I'm very, very excited about. And it's also a pleasure to welcome somebody back to the program that's been on the show before with other books that he's written. His name, the author, is Larry Tai. He's a prize-winning journalist at the Boston Globe. He's a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. He's also an avid baseball fan, and he now runs a Boston-based training program for medical journalists. And he's the author of The Father of Spin, Homelands, and Rising from the Rails. That was about the Pullman Porters, the black Pullman Porters. We interviewed him about that. And also co-author with Kitty Dukakis of Shock, about shock therapy, which we also spoke about. So it is a pleasure to welcome back from his home in the Boston area, Larry Tai. Larry, welcome back to the Peter Werbe Show.
Peter, it's great to be with you again.
And I didn't even tell people what the book was. It's Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. So a lot of people might be saying, Satchel? Well, I don't know that legend. It's Satchel Paige, perhaps the greatest pitcher of all times, eh?
Hey, I think he probably was the greatest pitcher of all times. He was certainly the most sensational pitcher. He performed a show as well as performing pitching magic.
Well, if no one's heard of him, or the people in the audience that haven't, there is one key element to why people don't know him as well as some of the great pitchers of baseball that we do know that are legends, because he was African-American.
He was African-American, and he played for most of his career in the shadows of the segregated Negro Leagues. And so he was playing out of view of most of mainstream America, most of the mainstream press. And it was legend because what he did out in those shadows was quite extraordinary, feats that have never been duplicated, and yet that most of America doesn't know about.
Well, that's certainly intriguing. Name a couple of things that he did that no one else has done. And also, if you will, Larry Tai, back up. I mean, that's quite a contention to say that he may have been the greatest pitcher of all times. I mean, there's certainly some great ones over the last 100-some-odd years, eh?
There are indeed, and it's an argument that baseball fans love to get into. Was Christy Mathewson faster than Bob Feller? Was Cy Young the greatest of all? Do we have an award named after him now? And it's perpetual that this discussion of who is better than whom is entered into. And people talk about various records that were set. Well, Satchel Paige set the kinds of records. Pitching 2,000 games, winning somewhere around 1,500 games, winning as many as 50 no-hitters. These are the kinds of records that on the one hand are things that would put him in a league that was different from anybody who was out there, and on the other hand, the fact that he did a lot of this in the Negro Leagues where nobody recorded it, and where nobody oohed and aahed over it the way they do when those kinds of things happen in the major leagues, means that we don't know about those records, that it's very difficult to authenticate many of them. But the ones we can authenticate suggest that this guy pitched longer and better than perhaps anybody in the entire history of white or black baseball in America.
Well, Larry Tai, place Satchel Paige historically. Like, when was he born? And tell us a little about his upbringing and how he got into baseball and all of that.
Peter, I don't think you meant to ask that question as a great mystery question, but the question about when he was born is an interesting one. In 1934, Satchel told a publication called Colored Baseball and Sports that he was born in 1907. In 1948, he told the Associated Press that he was born in 1901. He told Time Magazine he was born in 1903. And he told the Washington Post, the New York Times, and Sporting News that he was born in 1908.
Well,
the truth is that it was an extraordinary mystery, and it was considered one of the great riddles of baseball to figure out something as simple as when Satchel was born. And the truth is that it was all there all the time in a birth certificate in Mobile, Alabama, where he was born, which confirmed that he was born in 1906. And it was a mystery for a number of reasons. One is because African Americans, particularly in the Deep South back then, the records on them were really sketchy. There were, until 1900, there were often no birth records kept by community on African Americans. If there were records, they often had a big C next to them, denoting the fact that they were of what was called the colored race, and denoting the fact, if anybody had been paying attention, that they were about to get second-class treatment in everything, including something as simple as the recording of basic data on their lives.
Well, as you say somewhere in the book, you can't talk about Satchel Paige, you can't talk about American baseball without it also being a civil rights story as well.
It's true. There was what was called the Jim Crow era in America. It was the era of segregation that started shortly after the Civil War was over, when states, mostly southern states, started enacting laws requiring separate treatment of blacks and whites in everything from train and bus travel to something as simple as water fountains. And this whole Jim Crow era had a parallel sports universe, where we had teams that were called Negro League teams, teams that only blacks were playing on because those blacks couldn't play because of the color of their skin in the major leagues in baseball. And Satchel Paige's life is the perfect lens into that whole Jim Crow era in America.
Yeah, and we should note that there was a famous Negro League team. That was actually the name of the league here in Detroit, the Detroit Stars.
There was a team called the Detroit Stars. It was one of the great Negro League teams, one of the earliest ones, and it was a team that Satchel played against repeatedly. He loved coming to Detroit. Detroit was one of the places that had a growing African-American population in the early 1900s. Lots of the blacks who came to Detroit came from Satchel's native Alabama, and he played there a lot during Negro League games, during barnstorming games, when he was playing with just pickup teams, and he loved coming to Detroit and to Michigan generally.
Now, it's interesting the use of the word, not so much, we've gone through, colored and Negro and black and African American and all that, but how frequently that the race designation word was used in so many different as adjectives. Like, for instance, that when Satchel Paige, as a young kid, wound up breaking the law, he went to the Alabama Reform School for Juvenile Negro Lawbreakers. I mean, that's just incredible. Or the Detroit Police had a Negro Crime Section. That's what it was called. And rather than a league just being called, like, say, the something or other baseball league, that they actually called it the Negro League.
Exactly. And it was for two reasons. One, it was because, particularly in the South, in a place like Alabama, everything was so explicitly segregated that things were called white, things were called Negro, and they wanted to have a clear-cut designation so there was never any chance of anybody making a mistake or being unclear on which race they were dealing with. And things that were race you wouldn't have thought would have entered into any of the discussion. As you say, it was right there in the label, including something like a reformatory where Satchel spent several of his most formative years as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about Satchel Paige let me just take this opportunity. I'm so into this book that I'm making the assumption that everyone knows what we're talking about, but some people may be just joining us. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Larry Tai, and he's written Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend, and Satchel Paige was a African-American athlete, pitcher, and as we'll get into, an incredible person as well, that pitched, I believe, up till 1965, didn't he?
He actually pitched his last major league game in 1965, where he set a record that will never be broken. He was 59 years and 2 months old when he pitched for three innings against the Boston Red Sox for what was then called the Kansas City Athletics. And he was brought in by an owner named Charlie Finley, who was a real character, as a stunt. He thought it would pump up bad attendance, and so he put him out in the bullpen with a nurse in a white uniform standing next to him to attend to his needs, and then he brought him in to pitch three innings against the Red Sox. The extraordinary thing was only one guy on the Red Sox, named Carl Yastrzemski, managed to get a hit. And I interviewed all the surviving members of that Red Sox team, and they say that at age 59, Satchel had more in his pitches than the young Bill Mombouquette did pitching that night for the Red Sox, and it was just extraordinary, his longevity. He started out in 1926 pitching his first professional game in the Negro Leagues. He ended up his major league career in 1965, nobody last that long, and nobody ever will again.
45 years of pitching. Wow. Well, I want to talk about Satchel Paige off the field, because he's got quite a history there as well, and you chronicle it in your book, Satchel. But let's talk a little about his athletic prowess and his pitches. And he had a blazing fastball that he was well known for. In your book, you chronicle how fast it went. I mean, now they can do it, but were they actually able to measure the speed of Satchel Paige's pitch way back then?
They weren't able then, and what I did is two kinds of evidence I was looking for to understand just how fast, because one of the great ways, as you suggest, that we measure a pitcher's prowess is by how fast he can pitch. And so one way I did it was talking to guys like Bob Feller, who pitched against him, and all of whom swear that it was, at a minimum, his fastest pitch was 100 miles an hour.
Oh.
May have been faster than that.
Oh.
The other way to measure it is I had some scientists and engineers at MIT and at other schools take film, the old crude film of Satchel pitching, and if you can follow a pitch from the time it leaves the pitcher's hand to the time it arrives in a catcher's mitt, you can measure speed. And these were in the late days when Satchel was in his late 50s pitching, and even then he was pitching in the high 80s and early 90s in terms of his mile per hour measured speed. So the idea that he was pitching at 100, catchers used to say that they would have to coat their gloves either with newspapers, putting newspapers in between their hand and the catcher's mitt, or using a stake. They'd pound a stake thin and actually put that in their glove to cushion it, because otherwise their hand would be stinging by the end of a game of catching the Satchel Paige fastball. And when you hear enough people tell those stories, you say, geez, even if they were good storytellers, people couldn't tell the same stories over and over again, different people pitching in different parts of America, all of whom said that Satchel had the most deceptive and the fastest pitch that they had ever seen.
Well, Larry Tye, tell us about that aspect, too, deceptive, because a blazing fastball, people are considered having a miraculously fast fastball, isn't it, about 92, 93 miles an hour now?
They are. And if you get into the mid-90s, that's extraordinarily fast.
And here talking about Satchel Paige throwing over 100, but he didn't depend just on the fastball, did he?
Well, he didn't. He had lots of other pitchers, particularly as he got older and as he had to protect his arm. He developed a changeup. He developed a curve that started out, as he described it, as a little wrinkle of a curve, and ended up as being a really substantial curveball. He could throw a knuckleball, but he also did something that was really unusual and that you never see in the same pitcher all these things today. He could throw the ball overhand, which is a standard way of throwing it. He could throw it sidearm. He could throw it underhand. He could throw it with a windmill windup, where he actually started looking like a windmill. He'd churn his arm around and around, and it looked like what you used to have to do in churning a car, the old Model Ts, when you'd have to wind up the car. Well, he was winding up his arm to give himself extra speed. And he did it partly because it created deception. He did it partly because it looked like a great show. And he did it partly because it worked.
Now, when Satchel Paige began in the 20s and the 30s and through the 40s, baseball was the premier sport. I mean, football, basketball, hockey, I mean, these were, you know, really almost, not, I don't know if they were completely below the radar, but they didn't match baseball. And people were crazy for baseball. And we had cities like Detroit, as we said earlier, that had a Negro League team like the Detroit Stars. Was white America at all aware of Satchel Paige, even though he was excluded from the segregated major leagues?
White America only became aware of Satchel in the late 30s, when mainstream press, Time Magazine, the famous Saturday Evening Post, Collier's, magazines like that, that were magazines that white America read, they started doing stories on Satchel. And that was the first exposure white America had to Satchel Paige, who had already been pitching by then 10 years in his prime. It was also the first exposure that white America had to the Negro Leagues generally. It was Satchel Paige who brought the spotlight to the Negro Leagues and to the whole world many people of how blacks were living in segregation. One of the first ways most whites ever really got a sense of what went on in black America was coming out to watch Negro League baseball, and especially coming out to watch the great Satchel Paige pitch. And in a city like Detroit, one of the great events, particularly on a Sunday afternoon for black America in the 1910s, 20s, 30s, and through the mid-40s, one of the great social events was after church for women to put on their stoles and to put on their finest hats and shoes, and for men to put on their hats and their suits, and to go out to a game after church to watch black baseball, and particularly to watch when Satchel Paige came to town. This was putting on their best. It was meeting all the people they had seen in church in a nicer social setting to converse, and it was having a great time coming out and watching the great Negro League ballplayers who were stars in the black community and eventually in the white community.
Now, I think that the stadium that the Negro Leagues played in, the Detroit Stars' home field, was on Mack Avenue on the east side, but I was never there, so I can't swear by that. Let's talk about the integration of baseball. Now, am I correct that both Jackie Robinson and Satchel Paige, whose biography we're talking about, Satchel, The Life and Times of American Legend, published by Random House, by the way. Larry Tai is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. That both of them played for the Kansas City Monarchs, which was in the Negro Leagues, correct?
They did. And the fact that Jackie Robinson was the first player hired to play in the major leagues and to break the color barrier was no accident that it was the same team that Satchel Paige was on, the Kansas City Monarchs. It was only because of the spotlight Satchel had brought to the Negro Leagues and to the Kansas City Monarchs that Branch Rickey, the owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers, ever heard of Jackie Robinson. He started out the season that he was signed as a second baseman for the Monarchs, and it was when there was an injury to another player that he got the start. And he was good, but he was young, and nobody had ever heard of Jackie Robinson. And it was because Satchel had made the team famous that white America and that Branch Rickey knew about him.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me if you've heard this story. This is maybe apocryphal, that Branch Rickey and the owner of the Chicago Cubs, they were at a Cubs-Dodgers game in like 1946, 47, right before all the Jackie Robinson events occurred, and there was about 2,000 people in the stands. In other words, a terrible turnout, and then somehow or other somebody told Branch Rickey that there was 20,000 black Americans watching a Negro League game on the other side of town. And a lot of it was, in fact, economic motivation, that they wanted to expand the audience base by bringing in black Americans to play.
Peter, you're exactly right that economics was a motivator, but it actually worked both ways. On the one hand, there was a motivation that you're talking about, understanding that the way to fill the stands at a time in the 1940s when America was coming out of a war and they had to bring people back to realizing that baseball should be the all-American sport, the way to fill those stands was to get the best ball players you could, and that meant getting guys like Jackie Robinson and Satchel Paige on your rosters. So there was an economic motivation to fill the stands, and that was a positive motivation in breaking down the color barrier. The motivation in keeping the color barrier was that white owners would rent out their ballparks when their teams weren't there to Negro League teams. So Yankee Stadium, we all know, was the home of the New York Yankees. Many of your listeners may not know that it was also the home of the New York Black Yankees, who played there a lot of the time when the Yankees weren't around. And so the motivation to keep those rents going and to keep segregated baseball that would be coming in and having its team rent their ballparks kept some owners from wanting to integrate when Rickey started the movement. So economics played a huge role as a motivator to break down the barriers, and for others, it was a motivator to keep them.
Well, let's do this. I've just looked at the clock. We got about 5 minutes left, and we haven't even talked about Satchel Paige, the man off of the field. But I did want to bring Satchel Paige quickly into the American League, because he finally did play on the big league teams.
He did. In 1948, the year after Jackie Robinson came up to the big leagues in Brooklyn. Satchel came and helped lead the Cleveland Indians. He was signed mid-season and helped lead the Indians that year to winning the American League pennant and eventually winning the World Series.
Yeah, and he was, what, 42 when he signed, right?
He was. He was given some votes for Rookie of the Year, and an extraordinary thing at age 42.
And so then, let me see, he was, what is it, I can hardly do the math, though. I mean, he played then for another 17 years. Was he in the majors the whole time?
He was in and out of the majors. He played a couple years in Cleveland. He played after a break, he played 3 years. For the old St. Louis Browns team, and then he played very briefly for the Kansas City A's. So he was in and out for, you know, from 1948 through 1965, when he again set that record for being the oldest major leaguer ever.
All right, and Satchel Paige, off the field, quite a character.
An extraordinary character, a guy who just anything he did, he'd show up in a room, and quickly all the attention would turn to him. He'd be telling stories. He'd be attracting women to his arm. He would be singing. He'd be playing the piano. He was a guy who was a born entertainer, and he was a dream for any owner who had him on his team because he entertained the owner, he entertained the fellow players, and most importantly, he entertained fans just in the way he walked out to the mound. He got fans riled up and excited.
Mm-hmm. And he did all right financially through most of his life, didn't he? Is that correct?
It is. When he was pitching for the Negro Leagues, it was said in his later years, in the late 1940s, that he was making more money than Mickey Mantle, than Joe DiMaggio, and than any ball player, black or white. And he did it, though, by working extraordinarily hard. A normal major league ball player starts pitching in the spring, and by September, and if they're lucky and they make the playoffs by October, their season is over. So they've got from October to April to take time off. Satchel Paige pitched year-round. He pitched in the Negro Leagues. He pitched in Latin America. He pitched barnstorming across America, and he worked just about every day, pitching at least three innings, sometimes pitching an entire ball game, nearly 365 days a year. So he earned more than anybody, but he worked harder than anybody.
And he came up against some of the greats, right? He actually pitched Joe DiMaggio and some others?
Yes, they knew that Joe DiMaggio was ready to be called up to the Yankees when he got one hit and four at-bats against Satchel Paige. The scout for the Yankees telegrammed the owner saying he's ready. He got a hit off Satchel, and it was extraordinary. He faced all the greats, from Ted Williams to DiMaggio.
Well, I was going to say, how did they happen to be, since baseball was segregated, how did they happen to be having Satchel Paige pitch to them?
Good question. DiMaggio was playing on a minor league team in California, and they brought in Satchel and his black team to play against Joe, basically to see whether Joe was ready to be called up to the majors. There was integrated baseball in America much earlier than Jackie Robinson's signing in 1947, only it was in things like a winter league in California, or in some of the barnstorming games, or in play in Latin America. It took till 47 for the majors to integrate, but minor league operations were much smarter and understood the great ball players that were in the Negro Leagues, and so they didn't wait to 47 to have blacks and whites play against one another.
And Satchel Paige is in the Hall of Fame, isn't he?
He was. He was the first person to be inaugurated into the Hall of Fame whose inaugural was based more on his Negro League's participation. Today, there are lots of Negro Leaguers in there. The first one was the greatest of them all, Satchel Paige.
Absolutely incredible. And radio listeners, you may think, wow, they've really covered the story. We have not even gotten barely beneath the surface of this incredible book. It's called Satchel, The Life and Times of American Legend, the Great American Pitcher, Satchel Paige. My guest has been Larry Tye. You can go to Larry Tye, that's TYE.com, and all the information is there. There'll also be a link on my website as well. Larry Tye, as always, fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us again on the Peter Werby Show.
Peter, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on your iPhone 3G. We hope you'll take a brief survey about how you use your iPhone at WRIF.com/iPhone. And thanks for listening to The Riff worldwide at WRIF.com.
The international record labels are asking Congress for a handout, and they want to take it from your local radio stations. That may mean stations like this one have to cut back on the music we play or the community services we provide. Representatives David Kaff and Gary Peters can help by sponsoring a bill to keep the radio you love free from a performance tax. Call today and ask them to sponsor the Local Radio Freedom Act and oppose a performance tax on free radio. And thank you to Representative Dale Kildee for his support of free radio. Learn more at noperformancetax.org. This message furnished by the NAB and this station.
Do you know the fastest way to learn a new language?
Memorization?
We always did translation.
Is it drills?
The world's fastest, easiest way to learn a new language is Rosetta Stone software. It doesn't waste your time with tedious translation, useless memorization, or boring drills. Instead, it teaches you a new language the same way you learned your first language. And right now, you can experience it for yourself because Rosetta Stone is offering a free demo CD-ROM. Check out the easiest, fastest way to learn the language of your choice. For the free CD-ROM, call 1-800-337-1442. Discover what U.S. diplomats, NASA, and over 10,000 schools already know, that this is the world's fastest, easiest way to learn a language, guaranteed. Choose from 31 languages and request your free CD-ROM today. You'll be amazed at what you learn. Just call 1-800-337-1442. Request your free CD-ROM from Rosetta Stone by calling 1-800-337-1442. That's 1-800-337-1442.
Do you owe too much money on your credit cards? Do you have over $12,000 in debt and don't know how you'll pay it off? I have a proven program that can help solve your debt problems. I'm Ted Brower, founder of Debt Settlement USA. Credit card debt can cause serious financial hardship, especially if you have loss of income, you're going through a divorce, or you have costly medical bills. Before things get worse, call Debt Settlement USA. We'll show you how to get rid of your debt faster than you think, without bankruptcy and without taking out another loan. Just call Debt Settlement USA right now for a free consultation. Your call is confidential and there's no obligation.
Call 1-877-560-8877. If you have over $12,000 in credit card bills, find out how Debt Settlement USA can help you. Not available in all states. Call 1-877-560-8877. That's 1-877-560-8877.
Do you want a wireless laptop but your credit score is holding you back? We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronics Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Then hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased with their service, so I would suggest to anyone that is looking for computers or trying to find computers, Tronics is the best place to call.
Call now and lock in your free gifts. You will not be turned down. Call 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258.
Back to the Riff.
Well, that was loud.
101 WRIF.
Run the Riff.
Bow down before the one you serve. You're going to get what you deserve. Bow down before the one you serve.